time than just, you know, an average year, is that I wanted to make it more of a discussion share, more of not just me lecturing to you and hearing what I have to say, but I would love to hear what you have to say too, which is why I asked you to prepare a little bit so that we are coming from different places, because some of you may have looked at Mefarshim that others of you may not have looked at. So I'm hoping that everybody will contribute whatever it is that they learned as we go along. I was trying to figure out a topic that I don't teach at Stern, so none of you have heard from me before. And I realized that always we focus on good people, heroes, I guess I would call them in Torah. I'm sure many of you have heard like a million shirim on Abraham and Moshe and Sarah and people of that sort. But very rare do we get to learn about the bad guys, the villains, and I think that there's a lot to learn from them as well. It may just be the simple fact, don't do that, but I think that there's a lot more, which is why we hear about them in Torah. I don't think that, you know, if there was nothing to learn from a villain, we wouldn't hear as many details as we do. So the question that I want to present to you today is really the question of how bad are the villains in Torah? Are they horribly, horribly evil, or are they actually not so bad? And what are we supposed to learn from them dependent on how evil or not how evil they are? There are tons of villains in Torah, so I picked really two, I would say top two villains that I think that we all come to the table already knowing their story, so it actually puts us at an advantage, which is, of course, Yishmael and Esav. I want to do them separately, so we're going to start with Yishmael, then we're going to move, if we have time, to the discussion of Esav. What I find so interesting is that, let's say you're watching a movie, right? Within the first 5 minutes of the movie, you know who the villain is, because the villain looks a certain way. You know, they normally are pretty ugly. They probably have, like, some sort of, like, pointed nose or, like, evil eyes. They never smile. They're mean to everyone. Like, you always know how to identify a villain. And the question is that the way we portray our villains in Torah as well, or do we not? If you look just at Source 1 with me, you see, and to some extent, that might be the way that we're supposed to portray our villain. Source 1, the Gemara and Megillah. Am I searching? Hu Achashverosh, you all know this from our own shore. Hu Berisho Mitzpilasavat Sofa. Why does it say Hu Achashverosh? To tell us he's the same Achashverosh from the beginning to the end. He's evil from beginning to end. Hu Esav, Hu Berisho Mitzpilasavat Sofa, Hu Datam Avira, Hain Berisho Mitzpilasavat Sofa. You're evil. You're evil through and through. You're evil from the beginning. You're evil to the end. There's no change in your personality. You might get more evil, but you're not dipping into good and then back into evil. You're just evil the whole way through. That's kind of that same personification that we see very often when we're reading books, when we're watching movies, where there's one just horrible, evil character. And I think it's, like, interesting to me because that's normally the way these characters are portrayed when you're in elementary school, sometimes high school, and sometimes even beyond. Like, I know that if my kid is going to come home with a picture of Haman, he's going to look a very specific way, you know, with the pointed hat and the mean face. And the, like, that's the way we portray these characters in our mind. But the question is, that's not normally, if you bump into someone down the block who's not a nice person, they don't look that way necessarily, right? I mean, when you're in a movie, you're casting a certain character, so you're looking for certain caricatures. But that doesn't make sure that reality is that way. So that's what I want to know. I want to know how bad are these characters? How am I supposed to view these characters? And what's so interesting is if you go through all of Torah, you see that every evil character is always matched up with a good character to kind of contrast them. So they look even worse because compared to this guy, wow, do I look worse. Just think about it. Cain, we contrast him to Hevel, right? So even though I don't necessarily see Hevel as a positive character, because you look through the text, he gave a korban that's accepted by God, but he's not like this amazing tzaddik of any sort of way. He even copying his brother to give that korban. It wasn't even his idea. But when you put the two together, all of a sudden it's like good guy versus bad guy, which wouldn't necessarily be true if I looked at them individually. Or Yishmael somehow looks worse because I compare him to, of course, Yitzhak. Or Esav, of course, looks worse because I compare him to Yaakov. Power looks horrible because I compare him to Moshe. Achashverosh because I'm comparing him to like Esther and Mordecai. But if I just looked at these people on their own, just take Achashverosh for a minute. He's a character we all know. He's a really drunk guy, right? He's a really drunk guy who maybe makes poor decisions based on his advisors, but I'm not necessarily seeing an evil character. But all of a sudden, I put the Jewish people and the Jewish value into there, and all of a sudden, Achashverosh seems to look much worse. So that's what normally happens in Torah. We don't normally have a bad guy on his own. We always have a bad guy that's compared to somebody good, and that's why he looks so much worse. So let's start with our discussion of Yishmael. I'm sure, I don't know if everybody did Yishmael, everybody did Esav, you did both. What did we get through in Chavruta time?
Esav.
You did Aesop first. What? These are kind of both. Okay, fantastic. So let's see what everybody did as we go along. You have your, you don't need a tenor because everything I'm going to be referring to is in your source sheet, but if somebody's bringing up something, then it would be nice if you could all look it up with them and stuff. We'll start with Yishmael. The basic storyline of Yishmael is really a very nice, you know, storyline. It's not like, you know, something lightning struck and Yishmael was born and everything is evil. But rather, as we all know, Sarah couldn't have a child, so Abraham marries Hagar, and he has a child with her, all very nice. And it would really seem that if you're following the storyline, that Abraham thought this was his chosen child, right? And therefore, it can't be that evil is exuding from him, because how would Abraham assume that this is the chosen child if there's something so evil and horrible about him? It would seem he's a normal child, and he's growing up in Abraham's house. And we don't hear anything really about Yishmael until he turns 13, when he gets a bris milah with his father, right, which would be in Perek Yudayim, when they both get a bris milah. And, okay, so sounds all good. According to our story, normal kid, maybe a very good kid, we don't even know, who's growing up in his father's home, which, again, you would assume this is Avraham Avinu, so it exudes, you know, chesed and good midos, and you would think that that's what it's being instilled inside of Yishmael. And then at the age of 13, as we all know, the bris milah is commanded, and God reveals to Avram for the first time that he's going to have another child through Sarah. His name's going to be Yitzchak, he'll be Yitzchak, he'll call Chazera, and it's not going to be Yishmael. As we all know, if you look through the Pesukim, at the end of Perek Zion, Avram argues a little bit, with Yishmael Yechiel Lefanecha, no, it's supposed to be Yishmael, which would mean that in Avram's mind, Yishmael is not just the child he thinks is going to be the chosen child, but he even must think that he's worthy to be the chosen child, right? It's not like, oh, thank God, you know, it's not like, oh no, Ben Damesek Beiti Eliezer, oh my gosh, I only have this guy who's not really the one that I want. He doesn't react that way, like, thank God you're giving me another one, because this one kind of stinks. He's like, what are you talking about? This one is great, this one is wonderful, so why are you replacing him with somebody else? Then we all know the story, which is your source number two. Yitzhak is born, and Yishmael gets kicked out of the house. Now, if you look at the Pasuk, which I'm sure many of you who did Yishmael obviously looked at this Pasuk, that's really the only thing that we hear about what Yishmael is doing. He is mitzachek. And when you first look at it, you know, from a pshat perspective, you really don't understand the story. Mitzachek, he's playing, he's fooling around. I mean, he's a child. Could you imagine? I mean, this kid is 13 years old. No, he's a little bit older now. Okay, so he's, what, 14 years old. You know, oh no, you know, he's playing. Shame. You know, what am I going to do? Kick a child out of the house. And that's where you start to wonder here, what is true and what is not true about Yishmael. And then we have to go to two different extremes, okay? One extreme, which is always an extreme, and this is a pattern that we always have in Torah, and if I've taken my classes, know that this is a pattern, which is, let's take good guys for a second, okay? A hero in Torah, David, Moshe, people like that sort, right? So either we're going to say they never mess up, they're never bad, and they really never really do something wrong, and if they do something wrong, it's really, really tiny. But if I say that, I have a fundamental problem. What's my problem?
They get punished,
and they get punished normally pretty drastically. So the answer to that question, if I'm going in that line of thinking, is they must get punished tremendously, even though their sin is really very tiny or not existent, because they're tzaddikim, and God judges tzaddikim more harshly, and therefore it must be that because he's a tzaddik, he's being punished really harshly for something very small. The other side of the coin, you look at the pshat of the psukim, they messed up, they sinned, so they deserve a very strong punishment. It's really two different ways of looking at all the stories of heroes. It's the same thing about villains. Are we going to say that because a villain seems to be rejected so badly in the psukim, that therefore what?
Everything they do is inherently evil.
Right. Then what they did in the pasuk, which may sound like nothing, must be something that's horrible, horrible. Because if it isn't horrible, then they wouldn't deserve the punishment that they got, right? If our idea here, and that matches with what we said about the tzaddik, if our idea is that a tzaddik gets punished more harshly for something small because they're a tzaddik, then you have to contrast that to the Rasha. The Rasha, therefore, must only get punished huge if he does something huge, right? Because he's not a tzaddik, so I wouldn't assume that he's going to do something that's so, you know, so tiny and get punished tremendously. It must be he did something huge. But on the other hand, if you look sometimes at the psukim, like this one, it sounds like Ishmael gets punished really badly, gets kicked out of his own home, and he didn't do something so great. And I think that's where Chazal is coming from when they say this must have been greater. This must have been bigger. Take this word Metzachik and make it bigger. Because it has to be. Because if it isn't, there's no reason Yishmael should get kicked out of the home. He may not be the chosen child, but why are you kicking him out of the house? And that leads me to our famous Tosefta over here in source number 3. I'm sure you've seen this in many different versions, but it's normally a quote here from this Tosefta. Darash Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva made a drash. That when Sarah sees that Yishmael is being mitzachik, must be huge. But it must be so huge, says Chazal, that it has to be our three biggest sins ever. It can't just be like, you know, he was stealing from the neighbor. That's not good enough here. This has to be the biggest sins that we have in Torah. It has to be our three Yaharig v'Hayavur, because if not, why would he be kicked out of the home? So view number one was Avodah Zarah. How did she know he's doing Avodah Zarah? Mila mei chayta imenu Sarah ro'et Yishmael shaya boneh b'masin v'tzach ha'gavim. It must be she actually saw him serving Avodah Zarah. He was building these altars and he was sacrificing, or he was hunting these grasshoppers, and he was clearly v'maleh v'matil Avodah Zarah. He was giving up as Avodah Zarah. Second view, Rebbe Lazar, who knows of Yosi Hagdili Omer, Ains Choka Amar Kan El Hila Rites. It must be that we're talking about promiscuity. It must be that she saw him chasing around women, she saw him raping women in the field, she knew he was doing these terrible things. Or third, Rebbe Shmuel Omer, Ains Chok El Shvichas Adame, it must be murder. Murder, why? She saw him just like shooting arrows at random things, shooting arrows up in the air, and wherever it would fall, it would fall. I mean, he's a murderer. He didn't care if somebody got hurt. Now, this is a very far, far step to take from the word mitzachim. But again, the understanding of Chazal is, number one, he's our evil guy. He's our villain in the story, so we're going to make him very, very evil. And number two, he gets kicked out of the house. That's a very big result. He must be very evil. The Medrash Tanchuma takes it even one step further, source 4. Kayin sonei lehevel v'hargo. What he does is something that I love to do, which is always taking parallels. And if I can't learn something from the pasuk itself, maybe I could parallel it to another story and take something from there. We have other duos. We have other brother relationships where one is good and one is evil. So let me take another model of evil versus good, and I'm going to just take that application and apply it to here. Kayin sanei lehevel hargo. What do we have earlier than Yitzhak and Yishmael? We have Kayin hating Hevel, and he kills Hevel. Shenem bar v'yakam Kayin al Hevel achivar gehu, because the pasuk tells us he gets up and he kills his brother. We know Yishmael hates Yitzchak. We know that there's a parallel in the good and the bad, and one not liking the other. Must be, not only is he a murderer, but he actually tried to murder his own brother. Now this is a, realize, you read this midrash, that's a chiddush in the pesukim. I mean, there is no reason in the pasuk at all to assume that Yishmael tried to murder Yitzchak. But maybe there's a logical explanation behind this. Again, what would be something that would terrify a mother to such an extent that would cause her to kick another child out of her own home? What would that be? Well, the number one thing that would cause any mother is to protect her own child, to protect your child from somebody who might attempt to murder your child. Yeah?
And also then the next pasuk is talking about the Yerusha, so maybe also that fits with this, if you're trying to kill him so that he...
Right, it's not a let me get rid of him so that he won't inherit. It's let me get rid of him because he might murder my son and then inherit, 100%. Which takes us to these parallels, right? Kayin killing Hevel is because he wants to inherit it all, and it's all about killing for the sake of not just hatred, but also to inherit, you know, the chosen nation or to whatever their father has. And the Midrash continues. Esav sonei LeYaakov. Shneim bar v'yomer Esav b'libo. Yikrevu yemei Evel aviv v'hargat Yaakov achi. We see clearly in the pasuk Esav wants to kill Yaakov. So says the Midrash, we have precedence. Kayin actually kills Hevel. Esav wants to kill Yaakov. So it would make logical sense that Yishmael maybe wants to or attempts to kill Yitzhak as well. And therefore, we really have these models of evil, evil brother versus the very, very good brother, one wanting to kill the other, and therefore needing to protect the good one by rejecting the other one. I mean, the storylines are very, very similar. The problem, of course, is it doesn't say that in our pasuk about Yishmael. Yeah.
Why do you think that he's the villain at this point?
We have no reason to think he's a villain, but Torah looks at it from a bigger picture, right? So by the fact that he gets kicked out of the home and therefore cannot inherit the chosen nation, the assumption is he must be a bad guy, right? But we have to continue to build to try to figure out where is that picture coming from. Because I agree with you, there's absolutely nothing to assume that except for the fact that God says he's not chosen, the other one is, and then we kick him out of the home. So clearly we're not kicking out good people out of a home, right? I mean, if you look back at precedents, we kick Lot out and we don't think Lot's values are very good. We would call him a villain, though I'm on the line, you know, how evil really is Lot. I think he's more of a tragic person. But I'm saying he certainly would be, if I had to put, you know, hero versus villain in Torah, which, you know me, I'm very gray, so I don't like that. But Chazal is very black and white. Are you the good side or are you the bad side? But I agree with you, the Ishmael is somewhere in the middle, especially at this point. I don't even know why we are so negative. Yeah.
But what about the lines from, like, this narrator beforehand that describe Ishmael when he was first born? Like, Uhuya Para Adam, like, that's before we read that he's kicked out of the home. Like,
right, and those words are actually such strange words, because if you go through the Mefarshim, which I'm hoping some of you went to Mefarshim on different stories here, they don't even know how to translate that. Like, they don't even know what that means. There's not a comparison of that language, other places of Torah, that actually makes any sense about Ishmael. And therefore, I agree with you that those are very ambiguous words that could have a negative connotation, but they don't have to, and they're very strange. If you ask someone to translate them, they would have to translate that by saying, well, Rashi reads it as this, and Rabban reads it as this, because those words are very difficult, and we really are translating them in most Mefarshim as negative because of later stories, not because of the story itself.
The only thing that seems maybe not negative, but, involves conflict is Yadova Kolbi Yadkobo. That doesn't sound like a peaceful thing.
It doesn't sound peaceful, but I'm saying, and I agree with you on that,
yeah.
And I think, again, everyone struggles with those psukim, which if we had, you know, endless time, we would
right.
totally go through
right.
the first one of those psukim. But the question of, does that just mean that he's a dominant person, or does that mean that he's a violent person?
Right.
And what I also find interesting about that is, especially in these Gemaras about him being so negative, they don't even quote that pasuk, which I find very fascinating, because I would have thought that, especially if we're going towards the violent tendency, that that would be the pasuk that we would quote to say, here's proof that there's some sort of
right.
violence.
So it's not his action, he's not acting.
It's just talking about him.
Maybe it's not a good thing.
I agree with you. And it's interesting because, again, this is not something that I had prepared to talk about, because, again, there's so much. On Aesop also, the description right after he's born, that he's red and all that discussion.
Right.
So, again, is that a positive? Is that a negative? It's really unclear to me, especially because David is described as red. So, is that a description that we view as negative because of what we know of later about them? And therefore, if I just take the description, who knows what I would come up with in terms of that assumption. And I think that's all part of this picture, which is we come at Ishmael with negative eyes before we even start the story, because we know the bigger picture, which is he gets kicked out, and that later on in history, his people become people that hurt us to some extent, and therefore we need to look at him in this negative fashion. Very good. Let me ask you, okay, besides the fact that Sarah kicks him out, and besides the fact that, as Danielle said, in terms of the language that we have earlier, and the fact that later we are not so fond of the nation of Ishmael, is there any other reason in this story why we would say that Ishmael is evil?
Well, we're discussing parallels, and it reminds me, the Abraham-Sarah dynamic here reminds me a little bit of the Yitzhak-Rivka dynamic, which is that you have the father who's kind of clueless about which of his sons is deserving and which of his sons isn't, and then you have the wife who, knows what she's talking about and says, no, it's supposed to be this son that gets the inheritance.
Okay, so how do you know that God agrees to Sarah and to Rivka?
God says your wife is right.
Well, so that's the next obvious step, which is, if the pasuk ended with Sarah saying, let's kick out Ishmael, and Abraham saying, I don't want to, first of all, he probably wouldn't have been kicked out, but that would leave us still with an ambiguity here. But the fact that God says Shema B'Kola, and I agree with you, in the Rivka story also, we have a reason to assume God's on Rivka's side, because she is an earlier nevuah, Rabbi Avoda Tzair, that, again, unless you look at that as ambiguous, that which way does it go, but the pshat read of that pasuk is, the older is going to serve the younger, and therefore she knew, she had some sort of insight from God. Here, God actually speaks up. So if God speaks up to say, listen to her and kick her out, which kick him out, which is very, very drastic, again, that's going to taint us to say that there must be something more going on than, I just don't like this guy, so I want him out of the house. It's got to be more. You would think that God would not involve himself in something so petty, only if it's something that's very, very real. Yeah.
I mean, I think this also, that's really close to home, because with, like, right, even like right now, me and Yishma live in like very close proximity in terms of like who's living in the Middle East, who has Israel, who's the inheritance. So like God coming out and saying, no, the inheritance is actually through Yitzchak, like no less than that, like is very helpful in like.
It is very helpful. And now twice God has come out to say that, once to Abraham earlier, before Yitzchak's even born, not Yishmael, it's Yitzchak, and he comes out and says it here as well. So I agree with you, the way the language is paralleling here, the Yitzchak versus the Yishmael, is kind of one's good, one's bad. You could say one's chosen, one's rejected. That doesn't necessarily make him bad, which I think is obviously the other shot view. But there's one more point that we have to make. If you look at my source sheet, source 5, 6, and 7, in order to be able for Chazal to say that he's a murderer, he does Gilu Arayos, he does all these horrible things, they have to actually have textual proof that that's true. And therefore, it has to be that there are locations in Torah where the word mitzachek or sachak can mean those things, and it certainly does happen. And what's interesting is that they pick three different locations, one where it means each of those things. Just look at it with me very quickly. In source number 5, when we're talking about Shmos Lamed Bet, which is, of course, Cheta Egel, so it says, Vayakumu Letzachet. So what were they doing? They weren't playing there. They were doing Avodah Zarah. So that's a nice proof for Chazal that Mitzachet can mean Avodah Zarah, because here I have a location where Letzachet means that. Or source number 6, which we're talking about Isha Potiphar, and she says, here, my husband, Hevilan, is Isha Vri Letzachet Banu, and she's accusing Yosef of trying to seduce her and to sleep with her. So clearly, that's Gilur Arayot. And number 7, in Shmuel Bet, which is a less popular story, but one that I hope everybody knows, which is at some point in time, Avner and Yoav, Avner, who was the general of Shaul, but now is the general of Ishbosheth, and Yoav, who's the general of David, and they're kind of at war with each other because David is the king of Yehuda and Ishbosheth is the king of the other 10 tribes. So at some point, Avner and Yoav kind of are like hanging around, and they, I don't know if it's a joke, I don't know, it's not a joke, people die, but it's like such a strange thing where they say to each other, Yakumu na narim, talking about their soldiers, v'yisachakulafani, let them play in front of us. And what happens is they murder each other and thousands die, and clearly here the word sachak means to murder. So we have something where you could take that shoresh and you can apply it to these horrible, horrible sins. But the question here is more so, why are we doing that? So far what we're seeing is that Chazal wants to make it black versus white, the good character versus the bad character. There has to be a reason why Sarah wants to kick him out. He must be so terrible and so evil. God must agree, God does agree, and therefore again, it has to be something that is so incredibly bad. Can anybody give one more support to why we automatically view Yishmael as something that's terrible? Not, we said later on in history is terrible. So far the comparison to Yitzchak, he must be terrible. The fact that God says to kick him out. One more thing, yeah?
I think also just, even before he's born, like, Hagar, like, the whole idea that...
His mother is the answer to the question. Because there's an assumption that people come from two, you know, we know people come from two people, a father and a mother. And there's an assumption that you are similar to your parents or you gain the qualities of your parents. And remember, if you look at Hagar as a very negative character, it would make sense that from a negative character comes another negative character. If we look at source 8, we all know the story, I don't have to look at it inside. But the plan originally in Bereishis Tevav was not that Hagar should have a child and Hagar will be the mother of the Jewish people. That was never the plan. The plan was, Ulai Ibanamena, I want to build from her. I'm going to basically be the surrogate mother of this child. She's going to have it, but then she's going to be the surrogate mother. And then I'm going to adopt this child. It's going to be my child, Sarah wanted. But it's Hagar who does not seem to agree with that plan. Whatever this means, and these are lovely ambiguities, but take up the Virta Be'neha, she like brings her down in her eyes, meaning Hagar makes fun of Sarah or treats Sarah not in the way that she's supposed to. We all know something occurs between the two of them, whatever that is. Hagar runs away, but finally Hagar does come back and she does have a child. But the relationship between Sarah and Hagar seems to be one of negativity, seems to be one of Hagar not respecting her mistress, and seems to be one where if we view her as negative, it would make sense that there would be a taint or an issue when we look at that child. If we look at source number 9, what I found very interesting, if you look again at Sarah saying, kick out the child, who's the focus of the pasuk? But Tomer Lavim Garesh Ha'ama Hazot Ve'et Bina Ki Lo Yirash Ben Ha'ama Hazot Im Bini Im Yitzchak. Did you ever notice that before? She's the focus, not him. It's so interesting. Get rid of her. Oh, and her kid too. And get rid of him, but not saying his name. The son of Hagar. Get rid of her. She's much more the focus. So it's actually interesting here that seemingly, even though Hagar is not in the picture in terms of Mitzvah, she is totally part of this picture. Sarah is not just removing Ishmael from her home. She's removing Hagar from her home. And to some extent, it may even be Hagar that she wants to remove more. And whatever it is that Ishmael is doing, it's just an excuse for her to get rid of Hagar. All right, with me on that. The Ramban picks, oh, I'm sorry, the Kliyaka picks up on this, source 10. I found this a really interesting Kliyaka. Mitzad shehaya ben Hagar ha-mitzrit holida b'domela ki kol ha-mitzrit shitufei zima. Meaning, it's not that he was bad yet, but it's that she's already seeing that he's acting in a similar way to his own mother. And since his mother comes from a nation where things are very evil, so therefore, she, since he's taking on her characteristics, the assumption is he's going to take on the characteristics of her nation, of Mitzrayim, and not the Jewish nation, even though he comes from Abraham. And she wants to get him out of the house because she doesn't want Yitzhak to learn from the, you know, types of behavior that would come from someone from Mitzrayim. So it's an interesting idea where possibly she thought if she becomes the mother of Ishmael and Avram is the biological father, then he will just have the values of the Jewish people or the values of Abraham. But by the fact that Hagar's in the way, Hagar kind of hangs around, now she sees the values and this mitzachit coming out in Ishmael, and therefore she realizes Ishmael has to go. Yeah, which one is it?
At least if Sarah's just being jealous of her, that person.
So again, when it comes to good people in Torah, so there's a line. There's a line that we always have to balance between taking the literal text so literally that we lose the sight of the values that are coming through the text. What seems extremely clear is that Sarah is chosen to be one of the Amahot, and therefore Sarah seems to be a virtuous person in the text. Does that mean that every single thing that she does, therefore, has to be perfection? I don't think so. Some people do, right? That there are different ways of looking at heroes in Torah. Or is it possible there are some flaws in what Sarah has done? And therefore, I think that we do find in the Mefarshim saying that Sarah went too far when it comes to Hagar. But to only look at the story within the value of Sarah just wants to get Ishmael and Hagar out of the house because she's jealous and she wants to have her own kid and it be all about her and not about the values in any sort of way. Sometimes, even though I agree with you within the pshat, I may come to that conclusion. There's a line that seems to be crossed if I come out with a negative picture about Sarah as opposed to a bright Sarah versus a slightly less bright Sarah. That seems to be acceptable within pshat versus drash. But when I cross a line sometimes to make a good person into a bad person, like one time I heard a shiur, somebody gave that Yitzchak is mentally not fully there. And that was his thesis. I understood that every word of what he was saying was coming from the psukim. There actually wasn't any part of what he said that I could argue with because I saw the possibility within the psukim. I just can't say that. Do you understand? Like that goes against so many values that I have as a firm Jewish person of the values of the Avot and the Imahot. So that's why there's kind of a line here, which is, do I think that there was jealousy? I would assume so, because any woman would be jealous of somebody who has a child so easily when they don't. You know, like that certainly is just a normal emotion. We do see Rachel v'tekaneh ba'achota is jealous of Leah. And then Mefarshim even struggle there. Is she jealous or is she just like jealous of her midot? Because we want, when we give a negative attribute to one of the Avot Imahot, we have to stop for just a minute. We like that you just have to stop for a minute. So is this story just about Sarah being jealous and wanting to get Hagar and Ishmael out of the house because of her own jealousy? I personally can't go that far to say something like that. I think there has to be a value to the fact that they deserve it to some extent as well.
I also don't know, like, in that reading of that, she was like, I don't know what you would do with the puzzle beforehand, which is clearly focused on Ishmael, and she's like seeing Ishmael through some kind of behavior.
Right, again, mitzachik, whatever that is.
I don't know.
Right. So the question is she reflecting on his mitzachik, which is not something that's so terrible, and saying, but now I see the values of Hagar in you, and that's what the problem is? Or is the mitzachik itself really such a big issue? So if you look at the word mitzachik again, just to kind of now take the pshat perspective, source 11, source 12, the word tzachak in Torah normally means to laugh or it means to joke. That's normally what it means. Avraham by Yitzchak, we don't say, oh my gosh, Avraham was serving a Avodah Zarah. I've never heard that one before. He's laughing. He's laughing because he's chosen to have a child. Sarah bat Yitzchak, she's laughing because she finds that she's going to have a baby at the age of 90. Verse 13, they actually call his name. You ever think about that? Yitzchak, that's his name. So we're yelling at Yishmael and kicking him out of the house for being Mitzachek, but we're actually naming Yitzchak Yitzchak, and we're not naming him after serving Avodah Zarah or murdering. So it's the same shoresh that we're using interchangeably within the same story. I mean, it's not even a different story that we're talking about. It's the same story. Sarah even says in the last passage, I gave you Sechoka Tali Elokim, Kol HaShemei Yitzchakli. So clearly the pshat of this word is not Gilarayos Avodah Zarah. Everyone knows that. It really is about joking. And maybe I can make it negative. How do you make the word joking negative? Someone change the word? Mocking, right? I'm not just ha-ha laughing, but I'm making fun of someone. So that would be my negative way of looking at Mitzachek, which still is not like, oh my goodness, kick someone out of the house type Mitzachek. But that's where, again, I have my pshat versus drash issues. In the world of drash, my issue is, it fits the crime, right? So I have to make it greater than what it is to fit the punishment at the end. In the world of pshat, my problem is the punishment, right? Because if all he was doing was joking, or if he was doing even mocking, right? Why does that deserve to get kicked out of the home? Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm talking, but one of the my notes shows that in terms of the Mitzachek being connected to Gilu Arayot, there's the pasuk about Yitzchak being Mitzachek with Rivka, and then Abimelech finds out that they are husband and wife. So maybe that is some kind of...
I'm saying that's another pasuk where that word is used, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
The
and
one that I quoted before is the one
way.
In the Gemara. But again, they are doing something, they are doing a mitzvah of Ona. But for sure, the word sachak in that sense is joking around. And I'm saying you could also read that pasuk as they weren't actually in the middle of having sex. It could be that their mitzachek means that they were kind of foreplaying before, and that's what he saw. And that for that is a sort of joking around. But that's a positive joking around. In terms of joking around being negative, I gave you here source 15, where Lot, when he tells his son-in-laws, you know, that God's about to destroy the world, they think he's a joke. Like, they think that, you know, he's crazy. That would have a negative connotation, but again, that's more mocking. Like, yeah, right, you think the world's about to be destroyed. And then, of course, Sodom is, and they die, along with his two married daughters. And Ibn Ezra and Radak pick up on the more pshat view. I gave him source 15. Ibn Ezra mitzachek, he came in hakol nar. I think he just means play. Right? Every child does that. He was playing. He was acting like a regular kid. But tikanebo babur hayuka domi bina. And it really is, and he picks up on what you were saying, it was really about her realizing that he's older and therefore I'm going to have a Yerusha problem, so I want to get him out of my house. Radak mitzachek more negative. Ki'ilu mal'iga Yitzchak. He was teasing. He was mocking. He was making fun of Yitzchak. Shenola miskeinim, right? Because that's all we know so far. What would he make fun of him for? Wow, you were born when dad was so old. Oh my God. I mean, like, I find that funny because he was born when Avram was 86. Like, it's not like he was a young, you know, strapping boy. But okay, fine. But he's teasing him in terms of when he is born. So we certainly do see within the Mefarshim, the more pshat view. And then they have to deal with, what do we do with the fact that Yishmael is being kicked out, which they have to deal with, and it's a harder thing to deal with, which is somehow it's okay in the bigger picture, which is what we're going to continue to discuss. Ramban, I find, you know, kind of combines these two answers, and I really like this Ramban. Source 16. It was the day that they were having this party, which is what it says in the pasuk before. And she saw him teasing him at the actual party. Oh, Mishael Gadol, maybe he was teasing him because, like, wow, you get such a big party. I don't get such a big party. You know, like a kid. But specifically, the pasuk calls him the son of Hagar. Why? Because why? What does it remind her of? He's teasing Yitzchak. What does it remind him of? What does it remind Sarah of?
Hagar
teasing her. That's what this is about. This is about, again, from his mother and her seeing the qualities of Hagar in Yishmael. Below Amar Yishmael Mitzachet, V'chein Amra, Garashas Amah Hazobet B'naki Amra, Ha'evet Hamal'ig Ala Donav, Chayv Hulamut Ula Hakoto. Just like if a servant makes fun of their master, they deserve to die. So it's the same thing. I see him doing what she did to me. Be'enu wrote said, Raksha Tigaresha Tomiti. And really, I just want to get rid of her. I really just want her away. Jehu Ben Virat. The Amra, because, and he now, right, because my son is Ben Gvira, I'm the Gvira, right, and she's just the lowly person, she made fun of me. Now my son is Ben Gvira, Amra, Shigaresh Gamimo, Leki Lo Yuchal Hanala, Zovatimo, Zavatimo Vame, so I need to get rid of Yishmael, who's doing the same thing to my son, but I can't get rid of her without him, because they kind of go together, right? If son goes with the mother, and therefore I'll get rid of both. I think the Ramban's idea is actually pretty fascinating to me, because it takes the Pshat idea, it's really just about teasing, it's really just about mocking, but it makes me understand why Sarah reacts so violently, because she's saying it reminds me of your mother who mocked me. I see you in your mother, and therefore you both have to go. So at the end of the day, we really have two answers. He was horrible. He was a sinner. He was terrible. He deserved to go, and therefore they had to kick him out of the house. Or the second answer is, he wasn't really so bad. He wasn't so bad. He was a child. He was playing. He was making fun of Yitzhak maybe a little bit. So what has to be the answer? It has to be the answer of why we kick him out is because our house is about who's going to be on Israel, and you can't be part. It doesn't mean you deserved it from your actions. That's not what I'm saying. What we're saying here in the Pshat answer is, we see from your behavior that you don't merit to stay. That's all. It's not that you did something so bad that you deserve to go. You just don't merit to stay. It's kind of like Lot did not merit to be part of this nation. Yishmael, you're just not doing enough to merit to stay. And it's interesting, I give you source 17. I was trying to think of other places in Torah where we kick people out because we don't think that they merit to stay. And not necessarily because they did anything wrong. Name I think of before you look down? I gave you one. The other one, I gave you a pasuk because it's an obvious one. So the one I gave you in Zohar 17 is Yiftach, right? We see Yiftach, just because his mother is a Zona, his brothers decide he doesn't merit to inherit. It's not like he did something wrong. It's not that there's a story of Yiftach trying to kill his brother. There's none of that. He just doesn't merit to stay. Most famous Bereishit, who doesn't merit to stay in their eyes?
Yosef.
What's the story of Yosef? We want to get rid of Yosef because we don't think he merits to be part of this family. He thinks he does, and Dad thinks he sure does, but we don't believe he merits to stay. I mean, if you don't think of it that way, then the brothers are evil and they're cruel. And again, that's something that I just don't think that the Shvatim, and you look at the language of the Psukim, it's really about the fact that they think Yosef is really something else than what he presents to their father. They don't think he merits to stay. So within our understanding so far, it sounds like we have two views of Yishmael. The absolute villain, which is more the Midrashic view, which I want to show you in a second, is not absolutely true, versus the more Pshat view, where he's not such a villain, he just doesn't merit to stay, and therefore he has to go, but he really was just acting like a child, he wasn't doing anything so terrible. But the problem with Yishmael, which I find so interesting, is that that would be a very easy picture, and it fits the picture of so many villains in Torah, Pshat versus Drash, so simple. But then you start looking at more Midrashim, and you see that the line in the Midrash is so unclear and so difficult. And that's because they're struggling with a hashkafic problem. Can anybody think about what is the, I kind of hinted to it, what's the hashkafic problem if we make Yishmael into the evil, evil villain who has to leave the home because he serves Avodah Zarah and Gilu Arayos and all that? What is the hashkafic problem that we now have to deal with, which is a very difficult problem? Yeah.
That Avraham thought he was worthy.
Mm-hmm.
For many years.
Add to it. Avraham thought he was deserving and
Avraham
raised him. That's a hashkafic problem. How can I have someone like Avraham who raises a child that ends up being this way? It's a very difficult problem to deal with. That's why we have, you know, when it comes to Esav, oh, he was blinded, he didn't see, he was tricked, he was that. By Avraham, we don't have any of those midrashim. So the question is, how do we deal with that within Chazal? And that's where all of a sudden this gray layer starts washing over Chazal, where we start backtracking on certain midrashim to try to make Yishmael not as bad as we started before. I just ignored you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we're going to come to Esav in a few. Look at this Tosefta with me. The Gemara in source 8, yeah, the Tosefta in source 18. This is the continuation of the Gemara, the Tosefta that I started with before. But Ani Omer, this is what Shimon ben Yochai speaking. But Ani Omer, so we had two opinions already, right? And in that, those opinions, we have three opinions. All right, about the Zarish, we have Dharma, Gil Arayas, great. But says Roshim Ben Yochai, no way. Ani Omer Chas V'Shalom. Can't be. Sheyev Beit HaShalom to Tzadik Ahu. Can't be. Can't be that growing up in the house of Abraham and the Tzadik, that this is what I have. It just can't be that that's true. Ein Tzchok Avar Kan El Inyan Yerusha. It's just as someone said earlier before, based on the Pasuk afterwards. It's just about Yerusha. It's just about what do I inherit. He can't be in my house because he can't inherit. That's all. Kishe Nolad Avinu Yitzchak LaAbraham Avinu. Hayu HaKol Smechim Va'omrim Nolad Ben LaAbraham. Nolad Ben LaAbraham. Right? Yitzchak is born. Everyone's celebrating Abraham. Avram et Etan, Avram et Etan is amazing. Nochal et Ha'olam, he's going to inherit the whole world. Notel Shnei Chalakim is going to get two portions. Yitzchak gets everything. Haya Yishmael mitzachek b'da'ato. So what's mitzachek? He starts laughing. He starts laughing in his mind. He's like, I'm fool you all. Why? Haniya before. I'm really the oldest. But Anita tells Shnei Chalakim, I'm getting it all. So ha ha ha. But you think Yitzchak's getting everything. I'm getting it all because I'm his before. That's what mitzachek is. That's all. It's him wanting to get everything. That's all it is. He's not doing a vodah zarah. He's not doing gilah rice. And this is all within the same Tosefta. And what's the issue? The issue is the hashkafic issue of what do I do with Avraham as the father? And I think that now when you open that door, you start seeing a whole bunch of other Chazal ideas that fit into that theme. Some of them that you probably have learned many, many times in Mefarshim, like the next Rashi. Look at source 19. Ve'el ha-bakar rat Avraham ve'ikach ben-bakar rat v'tel is when the three malachim come. Ve'itain el hanar ve'meher la'sototo. What's the pshat? What's the pshat?
That Avraham is getting meal ready.
Right. And what does he do? He gives it to his nar. What's a nar? His servant. That's it. That's the pshat. Radak says that, right? It's a nar ala mesharis to his servant. What's the midrash? The midrash here, Rashi, is a Yishmael. Why? L'chan chov mitzvah. You can't assume that Avram didn't attempt with Yishmael. He had 13 years with this child by himself, and then whatever amount of time it took till Yitzchak was born, so like 14 years, right, that he was teaching him mitzvot. Of course he was. So this is Yishmael. He's teaching him the mitzvah of Hachnasas Orchim, for sure. Radak even says it. Pshat ala mesharis. Drash zeh Yishmael. Look at the next one, Akedas Yitzchak. At Akedas Yitzchak, this is even more difficult. Because in Bereishis Yitzchak, Yishmael lives in the home. He's not mentioned in the story of the angels visiting at all. He's not in the story, but one could argue he certainly lives there, and therefore it could make sense that the boy could be referring to the boy, his son. But when you get to Bereishis Chafet, what happened in Perachaf Aleph? He's kicked out of the house, right? We just learned that story. Perachaf Bet, therefore, the logic, the pshat, obviously would be that he is no longer there, right? So comes to our story, Kachas Binchas Yachitchas Yarata Yitzchak, and he goes up on the mountain with his Shnei Na'arim. What's the pshat again? Obviously, he's going alone with Yitzchak, and the Na'arim are servants, whatever it is. And the question that, of course, anyway, I took my course, we do this a lot, what's the significance of those Na'arim? Because they seem to have no significance at all. But to me, what's interesting is comes along Rashi with the famous Midrash, that who are they? Yishmael Ve'Eliezer. So why is he there? Why is Yishmael there, according to Chazal, if he's this horrible, rejected villain? Why is he popping up in our storyline? Why do we seem to still think that he has a relationship with Avraham, that he's coming back within the story, even though he got kicked out the parrot before? That would make it sound like he's not so bad, and therefore he's not kicked out of Avraham's home. He was just told, you can't inherit, you're not getting the Jewish people, but you could still show up, but when I do stuff, you could still have a relationship with me. And again, Radak points it out. Pshat, two servants. Drash, it would be Yishmael would be there. And it's kind of crazy to me. Why do we have this feel of like Chazal to kind of stick him back in all the stories? Another famous Rashi that you all read on that story, source 21. You know, why does it say it's Bincha, it's Yachidcha, Sherahapta? It's such an interesting Rashi. It's Bincha because Avram says, Amarlo, Shnei Banim Yishli, haha, God, you didn't tell me which one. I have two sons. He says, okay, Yachidcha. I don't have Yachidcha. Each one's the only child to his mother. Gotcha again. Like, that's how I read this Rashi. Like, Avram's like, you're not being specific enough. Amarlo, Sherahapta. Well, I have Shnei Hamani. I knew I ever loved them. But okay, fine, God says it's Yitzchak. So what it means in this Rashi, according to this view, is that Yishmael's still on the mind. Yishmael's still on the brain. Yishmael is still in the picture to Avraham. Even though we kicked him out in the parak before, Yishmael is still either physically right standing there, or Yishmael is just on Avraham's mind. I have not fully rejected him from my mind. And again, if you take that view, it is very hard to make him this horrible, horrible villain. Because if he's this horrible villain, then why is Avraham sitting here standing up and going, well, maybe it's Yishmael. Maybe he's the one I love. Maybe that just doesn't seem to fit within that picture at all. And then I brought you in source 22 this absolutely beautiful midrash, which I love to read, because it's a story that's behind the story. And again, it fits within this grayer picture of Yishmael not being so evil, and Avram really loving Yishmael and having a relationship with Yishmael even after he kicks him out of the home. And it's within Chazal. So that's why I always say to people, whenever you quote me, Chazal says this, Midrash says, you know what, Midrash says lots of things. And Midrash has lots of different views. And within Chazal, you can split them up into different views. But it's not always as black and white as you actually actually see. And therefore, yes, do we have a trend in Chazal that's very negative and hates Yishmael and thinks he's like the worst villain in the world? Yes, we do. But we also have a trend within Chazal that actually fits a little bit nicer within the Pshat, which is he's kind of a great character. He's not this horrible, terrible person. He just didn't merit to be in the house of Avram and inherit the Jewish nation. Look at this Midrash's name. It's going to be really beautiful. Source 22. Shalach Yishmael v'lakach lo isha mibnot Moab. So it happens to be, after Yishmael leaves Avram's home, he goes and he gets married, you know, to a woman from Moab. Va'asiyah shema. So her name was Asiyah. V'la'achar gimel shanim, 3 years later, halach Avram lerot et Yishmael, which means there is an assumption in this midrash that Avraham visited Yishmael, like they had a relationship. V'nishpal Sarah, I love this. V'nishpal Sarah she'eni yorei min agamah. Clearly, Sarah did not like this relationship. She was not so happy about it. So in order for Avram to be able to go, he had to swear to Sarah, don't worry, I'm not going to get off the camel. I just want to say hi. I just want to say, but I'm not going to stay. I'm not going to get off. Don't worry. It's a very interesting dynamic between Sarah and Avraham within this midrash, where it kind of, to me, it's such an interesting, you know, Sarah yoshev ba'ol, and this sounds more like Sarah's the pants, you know, like, you go, but no, you know, like, it's interesting. Makom she'yishmael sharu esham, don't worry, I promise I won't get off the camel, where Yishmael lives. Ve'yigeo l'sham b'chatzi ayom, he gets there, it's like a half a day journey, or it's the middle of the day. Ve'matza sham ishto she'yishmael, he finds Yishmael's wife. Amar le, he says to her, heichanu Yishmael, where is Yishmael? Amra lay, so she says back to him, Halachu v'himo, he's with him, he went off with his mother, la'vi peirov v'tamarim and hamidbar, to go get some food. Which is interesting, because in this midrash there's an assumption, which makes sense, that Yishmael and Hagar remain close and remain connected, but there's no reason to assume that they don't. And they went off, very neutral thing, they went off to get some food, nothing negative. Amarle says, so Amarle says back to her, Tanili me'at lechem v'ma'avayim, please give me some bread and water. You know, I'm kind of hungry, I'm kind of thirsty. Ki ayefan nafshi midarach hamidbar, because I am very tired. Does anybody see, because we just finished, you know, this popping to my mind, Megillas Rus, where one of the reasons that we don't like Moab is why?
Because they don't.
Because they didn't. They said no when we were traveling from... Exactly, that's what the pasuk says in Devarim, right? And they wouldn't give us food and drink. Do you not think that this midrash is stolen right from there, right? He married a woman from Moab, and here's our story. Midrashim always have a source within the psukim, and that's for sure the source here. So he says, and it's mamish what happens to us later, right, when the Jewish people are passing through the land. I'm tired. Can you please give me food and water? And of course, what does she say? She's from Moab, so she says no. Amar le, so she says back to him, Amy lo lechem lo mayim, I have nothing to give you, I'm really sorry. So he says back on Marla, so when this is what I tell you, Kishiyavo Yishmael, when Yishmael comes home, Tagidlo es hadvar ma'ila, tell him this message. But Amri lo, and he said to say to him, Chalaf es matan beitcha, change the entrance to your home. She'ena tov lecha, it's not good for you. V'lo ru'uya lecha, and it's not deserving of you. What's he clearly saying to his son? Your wife's not good enough for you. Your wife is not good. But what is the Medrash therefore telling us by virtue of saying that she is not a nice person, so you don't deserve her? What is Avram? He is a nice person. He is a good person. That's what this Medrash. He's not. If he was a villain, then his answer would be, you deserve her. You guys deserve each other, and I'm not visiting anymore. That's not what he says. You don't deserve her. Because she let me finish the midrash, Yavo Yishmael Hegidulos Hadvarim, and Yishmael hears this when he comes home. Uben Chacham Kechati Chacham. Okay, so since he's the son of a Chacham, he's a half Chacham, right? He didn't get wisdom from his mom, but he got from his dad. So he is smart enough that Hevin Yishmael Vishalcha, he understands the message, and he divorces her. Now that line to me is also important, because what does that tell you about Yishmael? He respects his father. Right? If they had no relationship, right? If he was an evil, evil villain, and we send him away, and we hate him, and he's terrible, A, he deserves this woman, but B, he would be like, I don't care what my dad says, I don't respect my dad, he kicked me out, he doesn't like me. But this measure seems to imply that there's a relationship between the two of them. Avram visits him, Avram respects him to the extent that thinks he deserves a good wife, and he respects his father back to the extent that he would divorce his wife over a small comment that his father makes.
Did you have a question? Just on the thing before, well, it's consistent with the Pesukim, because we always think that Avram thinks that Yishmael is a good guy. I don't think Avram ever says anything bad about Yishmael. I think like the line where it says that Yishmael actually listens to what his father said is a little bit more telling. It's also kind of similar to Esau, that we said.
So the question is, and here's, I'll just argue the other side, because yeah. I agree with you that we never see Avraham noticing that his son is bad and upsukim, but you could also argue that a father or a parent can see their child doing something wrong, but because it's your child, you want to ignore it. You know
right,
what I'm saying?
Say, like,
so it could be he also realized mitzachek is something bad, but in his mind, it's like, but he's my son, and I love him, so I'm going to defend him anyway.
Right, like, I think this could be more about Avraham being like, no, she's, you know, you're too good for her. Like, I could see somebody seeing that's their child regardless of what their child is.
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that, that any parent might think that somebody who's bad doesn't deserve their own child, whether they're wrong or right.
Right, I think it says a lot about Avraham being, like, good connected. I think, like, a lot of these about, like,
yeah, yeah. But again, I would find it difficult for Avraham to maintain his connection if his son is like vada evil, and that's why I think within these ideas of Chazal, Yishmael has to be somewhere in the middle. He's got to be something gray. Anyway, the midrash then goes on, and he marries a new woman, and Shalcha imo v'lakhalo isha mibeit aviha v'ketima shemai, marries a new woman. His mother finds him another wife, but this one time from Mitzrayim, makes her ketima. But same story, I won't get off, I promise, I won't get off the camel fight. Same story, I guess, on the day. She gives him food. And the difference here is he gets up now and he davens and he praises, you know, Yishmael, and he shall have the money in the world and everything should be good for him. And Yishmael hears about it and he realizes that his father always cared for him and always loves him. I mean, it's a fascinating midrash. But certainly the idea in this midrash is not the villain that was being portrayed in some of these other midrashim. Besides that, just source 23, two other rashis that I find so fascinating within this more gray view. Yeah?
Just about the whole asking the food, just reminds me of, like, are you there, Rivka? Like, it was the same kind of way of deciding whether it was, like, a good wife or whether she's going to give.
Right, so I like to just take the other side. When it comes to Rivka, it was more about her asking him, do you need some, can I get you some, versus coming and saying, can I have? So you could say it's like that, but it's a step below, meaning like he's not going to marry a woman like Rivka, but maybe he would marry somebody that for sure would give if you asked for it, you know, like one step below. Anyway, we have been fascinating rashis here that I gave you here about the fact that if you assume that Keturah is Hagar, that also changes everything. Because if Keturah is Hagar, then Hagar can't be evil either, right? If we're assuming that Yishmael is evil, a lot of that assumption was because he comes from a very evil mother, and therefore he's evil, she's evil, they deserve to be kicked out. But if all of a sudden Hagar is Keturah, then that means that she was never evil to begin with. Avraham kicked her out because of Sarah, brought her back in when Sarah dies, because that's when he marries Keturah, right? He marries Keturah in Perachah Hey. Sarah dies earlier than that in Perachah Gimel. And therefore, now he brings Keturah back into his life because he's like, okay, now that Sarah's out of the picture, I can bring Keturah back in. To the extent that even in Chazal, she's called Keturah, Shenaim Ma'aseha Keketores, because she acts nicely like the spices of Ketores. That's not evil woman that we were describing before. So again, pshat, it's Keturah is another woman. I'm not arguing that for a second. But what I'm trying to say that within the view of Chazal, there's a taint here within, do I look at them as evil, evil characters, or do I not? And the two different ideas within Chazal don't really go together. If she is somebody who is beautiful and nice, and then Avram is reuniting the family back together, then it would really seem again that this was not about evil versus good. This was just about not being allowed to be there to inherit the family. Not only that, the second Rashi that I gave you, I find fascinating, which is the assumption that why Yitzchak goes to Ber Lecha Ro'i, Shehalach Lavi Hagar LaAvram Avi Sheyasenu, he reunites Avram to Hagar together. He brings the Shidduch back together, which would then again mean it's not like Yitzchak hating Ishmael and they're evil. It's more like brothers that kind of reunite the family at the end. It's such a different picture than the picture that we normally have of Ishmael and Hagar. Yeah.
Yeah, just based on the Rashi, I think I saw that you quoted it later. This is that the two of them buried Avraham together. It seems like there's Hagar, and then she like does Tshuva and like becomes Keturah, and like there's Yishmael, and then he's like a really wild kid. But then like he comes back and he kind of like buries them together. Like I don't know, like. I don't know if like the whole time is really good, but it seems like to be
cool.
There's
and I think what you just did, which is what we're coming to in a second, is kind of the third way to look at it, right? Which is that you can look at a person and take all the stories about them and see no growth, and therefore judge a story that's earlier by a story that's later, Or you can see growth within a story, meaning maybe by the fact that they get kicked out, they learn some sort of lesson, and therefore in the future they change their ways to some extent, and just like we believe in the concept of tshuva, maybe Avram, you know, does as well in terms of when he reunites with them. And I gave you as the basis of the discussion that you're having is source 24. I mean, the entire idea of this concept of Yishmael doing tshuva, before we can even get there, we have to understand where would that idea even come from, and it's this pasuk. When we hear about Avram dying, it uses two different interesting language that gets picked up by Chazal. One is the Seva Tova. The Seva Tova means like he dies like very satisfied. It's only used very few times in Torah, three times to be exact. And the question is, what does that come to add? He died happy. Like, what does that even mean? And number two, the fact that it says, Vayikvaru oto Yitzhak v'Yishmael benav, and Yitzhak's name comes before Yishmael. Now, which name, let's argue this, what name should have come first?
Yishmael
because he's older. Yitzhak because he's more important. And in Torah, we flip. Sometimes it's the more important person who comes first, and sometimes it's the older person who comes first, but it's something that's noticed within this pasuk. So that's where this Gemara comes from, that you have just referring to the Gemara Bava Basra. Amar Rav Yochanan Yishmael asat tshuva b'chaye aviv, shenemar v'kru oto Yitzhak Yishmael benav, and that is the pasuk that he quotes. Where do you see tshuva in those words? Vayikvaru oto Yitzhak Yishmael benav. Two things. Who sees tshuva there? Where's the Gemara coming from? What's the proof? Yeah?
I mean, maybe the fact that Yishmael was okay with Yitzhak being first. Like,
okay, but let's say, and you are correct, but let's say the more simplistic answer first. Yeah?
They're both called Banav.
They're both called Banav. Yeah. Good.
So
further
like,
that.
Clearly included.
So,
in
like, he includes him as part of his sons. Good. And?
Also, they just bury him together.
They bury him together. So, let's take the picture of the Gemara, because we're biased now, because we've read so many Midrashim. According to this picture in the Gemara, Yishmael was kicked out of the home. And Yishmael has never come back, right? So the question of this Gemara is, how come Yishmael is coming back to bury his father? Why is he called Banav? If somebody's kicked out, we normally would say, you totally dissociated. So clearly we're saying he came back because he's reassociating with his father. So if we're assuming he was out and now he's back in, what's the idea that has to come into play? Tshuva, which is what you mentioned before, which is the Gemara is coming from. So number one, he's there to bury his father. Number two, he's called his father's son. But number three, as you pointed out so nicely, his name comes second. What do you mean?
He accepted the fact that he was.
But if you look at it that way, which I think is what I just showed you here in source 25 and 26, which is how they read it, which is by Yitzhak's name coming first, if you look at it as we do very often, which is the narrative is speaking, right? So God puts Yitzhak's name first because God thinks Yitzhak's more important. Then we learn nothing. But if we look at it as a way of the text to show us that Yishmael is acknowledging that Yitzhak should go first, and therefore letting Yitzhak be the head, right, of the action of burying the father, and him being number two, what does that show? That show he no longer what?
Made the original mistake of saying,
I am the Bechor. That, right? Meaning in that view, that was his whole mistake. I'm the Bechor. I'm going to make fun of you. I'm going to steal it all. I'm going to take it all from you. And here we have him admitting or letting Yitzhak take the dominant role, saying, I admit that you are not, that you are in charge and I am not going to be taking your role. And that's exactly what Rashi says in a more cryptic way. In contrast, that Yishmael Tshuva, the holich et Yitzhak lefanav. He lets Yitzhak go first. It's not just that Yitzhak's mentioned first. He lets it. Vehi, and now he brings out my second word that I pointed out to you, he seva tova shenamra be'avram. And that's why he says seva tova. Can someone explain to me that? Seva tova, what does it mean? No, you can be very satisfied. Why?
Because after all these years of having really two separate families, he sees them coming together, joining forces, and there isn't this tension that was there.
Right. And I think I'd take a step further. I think, and no father would ever die to save a tova if they know their son is a sinner. There's no father that would, knowing that their sons are fighting with each other and that there's rift in the family and that trouble's in the future. Save a tova means he died and all was good. So all was good, why? Because Yishmael was really never evil and he's always been in touch with Yishmael, or all is good because Yishmael turned his life around. Yishmael did tshuva, and now look, I respectfully see Yishmael treating Yitzhak in this beautiful way, or as I gave him gracious out because I like this language. Kan here, ben ama chole kavod ben avira. The issue that we saw that was highlighted by Ramban, right, which is the issue of not knowing your place. You're the maidservant's son. You are not the main son. Here, he hopped it. He got it. I'm supposed to be second. And here we see the undoing of whatever it is that we think Yishmael did wrong. So at the end of the day, what I think is interesting is two very different views, Pshat versus Drash, but also within Chazal itself. But we're left with a question. Can anybody tell me what is the question that we have not answered yet? We started out asking a question on the view of Chazal, yeah?
Like, what exactly did he do that was so bad that made him view in his life? Like, he didn't ever do anything so, so wrong, like in the Pshat.
In the Pshat, never. But I'm saying that's why they have to read this word to add in all these horrible things, because if not, I can't view him as a horrible character. I can't answer that question, meaning the question of why didn't the Pshat actually write what it wrote? I mean, I'll be honest, we wouldn't have so much fun learning Tanakh if Pshat always wrote what it meant, you know what I mean? So I don't know that we can ever answer that question. But I agree with you that on the other side, that's major support, that he didn't do such horrible things, because the Pshat never said. S.E.F.
And then why did he put him in this, like, evil character box for a member of those two? It's human. Why is that the objective, past assumption that he is a Russia?
So let me switch your question a second, because the question of why is not always one that we can answer. But what does that objective box that you just called it, of calling him absolutely evil, do with a lot of these midrashim that seem to kind of not make him as evil as before? I think that's really the question. The question of why we make people evil, we'll discuss at the very end. It's more of a lesson answer, not a textual answer. Which is, what do we do with these other chazals that don't put him in that evil, evil box? How do I make him still be that evil, evil person within that view? Now, let me ask the question a different way. What do I do? Some of them are really simple. We just say we're not talking about Yishmael, meaning maybe the Na'ar that serves the Malachim is not Yishmael, and that makes it much simpler. But what do I do with the Chazal, let's say, for a second, of Yishmael is at a Kedas Yitzchak? How can I keep him in my evil box and put him in a Kedas Yitzchak? Someone explain that to me. Yeah.
That he was waiting because he said, okay, my dad's going to kill Yitzchak, and then I'm going to take over.
Good. So one way to say it is from the perspective of Yishmael, which is actually source 28 that I gave you, which is exactly what Chazal says, which is Yishmael wanted to go to Akedas Yitzchak. It wasn't like we welcomed him to Akedas Yitzchak. But he says, Amar Yishmael, Achshav ha-makriv Avram et Yitzchak b'nolo ola b'kdamet, mukadet, he's going to kill Yitzchak, v'ani b'no b'charo, v'ani ha-yoresh et Avram. Here's my opportunity. I got kicked out, but now here's my opportunity to come back, because if Yitzchak's dead, Avram's going to have no choice other than to take me back. So it's kind of like waiting for my opportunity. The other question is, why would Avraham bring him? Meaning, I understand from Yishmael's perspective why I might want to come. Why would Avraham bring him if Yishmael is evil? Now, you can argue, Daniel, that he doesn't see it, he doesn't know. Sure. Why else? Famous chazal that you probably have heard before, Shuvanam HaChamor. He doesn't get to go. He has to stay behind. So what would be the reason? To contrast. Right? Isn't that always what this view of chazal is? Which is, you're the bad one, you're the good one. So come with, but you stay. You stay behind with the chamor, because you don't deserve to go. Meaning, even within Avram's view, there could be a constant contrast between within Chazal, it's like within Pshat is not there, but within Chazal, the contrast between the good one and the bad one. So therefore, if I'm coming to the Akedah, and all of a sudden it's, well, I have two sons, well, I love two of them, and I have this too, why do I bring two possibly with me in the view of Chazal? It's to say, you're the good one, you're the chosen, and you, Shivunam HaChamor, you don't deserve to be here. I gave you in Source 27, the famous Midrash of Shivunam HaChamor, like, you're like a donkey. You're no better than a donkey, because you can't see any more than he can see. Kind of the contrast between the two, even within this view of Chazal. In this view of Chazal, if he's so evil, 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 why does he bury his father? That's in the pasuk. I could just say he wasn't there. But why does he bury his father? He's not a husband. Why does he bury his father? Because he doesn't respect for his father. Evil people are allowed to bury their fathers, right? Give me a proof, which I gave you, but give me a proof. Asa buries his father, right? We know that Asa buries his father. So these are not hard. Meaning I'm saying you could take all these stories and you really can fit them into both explanations. But at the end of the day, what I struggle with, and Chazal did too, and I gave you two answers here within Chazal, is how do you have a tzaddik like Avram have a horrible, horrible son of Yishmael? That's the end of the day, the hashkafic problem that I think the middle view within Chazal is dealing with. So how does the other view, the view that we all know, the evil, evil, evil Yishmael, how do I deal with that problem? Yeah.
Like a literary perspective, or
why would Abraham bring Ishmael to tell him that he's on the top? Like, why would that be reason for him to bring his son?
So again, if the answer, the simple answer to the question is he didn't bring him. He's not actually there, right? That certainly there's no reason to say it within the Pesukim. But if you accept the idea within Chazal that he was one of the Na'arim, which again is all part of conservation of personalities within Chazal, that we don't like to have unnamed people, so we're the only people that we know, okay, it's got to be Eliezer, and it's got to be Yishmael. It's kind of the same idea that we use why we think Eved Avram and Terechav Dalet is Eliezer. It never says it's Eliezer. It's one of like my pet peeves when people say it's Eliezer. You don't know it's Eliezer. It's Eved Avram. That's what it's called. But in this story as well, I understand that that's what Chazal is doing. And the question is, how do I keep him evil, but then say that Avram brought him in? It can't be Avram brought him in as a, well, if he dies, here's my next in line, because if he's evil, he doesn't deserve it. Some Joe Schmo deserves it more than him. So it has to be that the assumption here is Avram is saying, okay, you're coming with me, but you're coming with me so I could say to you again, you don't deserve this. He deserves this. Witness this event, this great event of your brother, because this is not you. You don't deserve this. You know what I'm saying? That would be to be the chosen. I agree with you. We have lots. This is another problem that we have certainly in the Pesukim, which is what was Avram's view of what was going to be taking place between him and Yitzchak. Minashuva Alechem, right? It's part of our ambiguity in the Pesukim, and we will return to you at the end. So, what did Avram think is about to take place right in front of him? And therefore, you know what I'm saying? Does he think Yitzchak is coming down, or does he think Yitzchak is surviving? It could be Yitzchak, his brother Hazar. We have so many contradictions. That's a whole new world of problems, okay? Which I don't want to open up. Yeah?
I remember learning, I think it was from our parish, that he said that Yitzchak, because he didn't give his children, he didn't make a distinction in like the education that he gave his children, like he just treated them as the same, even though they were obviously very different people, that resulted in like
there
in like
Asa being a Rasha, he wouldn't
have been, had he been a different kind of father. I'm pretty sure it was
Rav Hirsch,
I'm not sure who it was from, but like that's like.
Okay. I mean, I can't argue. I don't know where any of the source of that idea would come from, except for maybe a psychological perspective, which is we all know that you are not supposed to treat all your children equal. And that kind of gives an explanation of something neutral that Yaakov did, which is just bad parenting, but not, you know, teaching a child to be bad, which could cause a bad result, which answers this fundamental problem. It's just textually, that's a very hard thing to argue because we don't really know. But again, Chazal struggle with this problem if you're in that view. Let me just give you two answers that they give. Source 30 and 31, if we just look at where I bolded, Al-Shlosha Dorot Lo Paska Zuha Mar Avotav, meaning there was a time period of the Avot was kind of like, I don't know the right word, where we're trying to get to perfection, right? We're trying to get to the Jewish nation. So we're trying to, in each generation, weeding out some bad, you know? So it's kind of like there was some bad that was going on, so it all concentrated into Yishmael, and then we wean out Yishmael. And then some extra bad that's still left in there got concentrated into Esav, and we get rid of Esav. I mean, this concept is a strange one for us to understand, but they're dealing with that problem. That's why Avram has to hold it to Yishmael, Yitzchak has to hold it to Esav, because we have to get rid of the bad in order to get to the good, which is, of course, Yaakov and his 12 sons. It's such an ironic midrash for me, especially if you know the stories of the tribes, where they're not so perfect either. But certainly that is the implication of this Gemara, which is there's bad intrinsically within, you know, human, and we humans, and we have to kind of get them out of the Jewish nation, and it therefore, on purpose, you know, concentrates into one son versus the other. But the second answer on the Gemara, source 31, Ein Avram Matzilas Yishmael, Ve Yitzchak Matzilas Esav. Meaning sometimes they're just such bad people. They're born that way. You can have a father like Avram, and he just can't. He can't save them. Like, there's nothing he could do. It's not Avram's fault. So at the end of the day, I just want to kind of center us so that we have a little bit of time for Esav, which is as follows. Within the view of Pshat, the storyline is really simple when it comes to Yishmael. Yishmael is born of a different mother. They're not necessarily evil people, but they're just not deserving to be part of the Jewish nation. The Jewish nation has to come from a combination of Avram and Sarah. So when Sarah has a child, Yishmael has to go. Whether it's because he was mitzachek that he deserved to go, or if that was just the incentive that got Sarah the excuse to say, let's get rid of him, but God wanting him out, because that's the process of this Jewish nation. Avram had to leave his family behind in Aram Naharai, then he has to leave out more, his father in Haran, then he has to get rid of Lot. He just, like, that's the process of Avram's life, getting rid of people from his family that just don't deserve to be part. And that's the story of the Peshat. Yishmael is not evil. Yishmael just doesn't deserve to be part of Am Yisrael. That's the Peshat of the storyline. If you take the extreme within Chazal, Yishmael is evil. And the reason why he's evil is because he gets kicked out, so he must have done something that's evil. So Mitzachek is evil, and they were influenced by the earlier psukim about his nature as something that's very evil. And he does terrible things, and therefore he deserves to get kicked out. He's out of the family of Abraham. Maybe he shows up just to kind of throw in his face again, you deserve to be kicked out. And Yishmael's out of the picture. He buries his father at the end, but he didn't make any turnaround whatsoever. And then there's more of a middle view. And the middle view can go in lots of different ways about Yishmael, which is it could be that he wasn't so bad from the begin with within Chazal. And therefore, he kind of shows up along the way. Avram visits him along the way. They have a relationship. He just doesn't part. It's kind of very similar to the Peshat view, but he's just not part of the Jewish nation. But I'm saying why it's midrashic is because it adds in stories that are not in our psukim about Avraham and Yishmael getting together at other periods of time. And maybe even Avram reunites with him at the end and remarries his mother and they all become part of the nation. Maybe. Or maybe it's Yishmael who's bad in the beginning, but does tshuva, as we saw before, turns it all around and then comes back. Who knows? I think there really are different views that we see within Chazal for Yishmael himself. Of course, the end question, which we'll get to after we finish, hopefully, ASAP, is what's the message I'm supposed to take from all of that? But I hope that you see very clearly that just by looking at Yishmael a little bit deeper, we see that there are a number of ways to see Yishmael. Just like there's a number of ways to see all of the heroes in Torah, there's not one way to look at a villain. A villain could be extremely evil, and a villain could even be not so bad, and a villain could be somewhere in the middle. Yeah?
So with the tradition that Yishmael is the forerunner of the Arabs, and the fact that we all have seen like that history play out and Rishonim have seen history play out, does that, do you think that factors into their character?
I think 100% we reflect backwards, and I think I said that in the beginning, one of the reasons why it's very possible that we have such a negative view about Yishmael is because of what's happened since, right? A lot of times we take later stories to reflect back on earlier stories, either to say they're not so bad if we assume the later stories Yishmael doing tshuva, or if you look at reality and see that the people that come from Yishmael are so evil, so therefore you want to reflect backwards and say, well, Yishmael must have been bad as well. That's certainly a very normal thing to do in Torah. Let's just move to Esav before we run out of time, because I see it's already 12:20. Esav has so many more stories than Yishmael. And within each of the stories of Esav, I hope that you saw, if you were running through those stories, that you could see him as very evil, but then you could also see him as not so evil. You know, I really think that in a lot of these stories, Esav's a bit of a victim. He may not be the smartest guy in the world. He, you know, you may come up with different reasons, or maybe a little rash, you know, he doesn't think things through so much, but that doesn't make you necessarily evil. I mean, I want to focus on two of the stories because we're running out of time, but let's just very quickly in my source sheet run through just the different stories of Esav, because he comes up 5 times in the psukim. We have 5 really different stories of Esav. Number one is, of course, Esav's birth. Now, you can go into the description of Esav. I just want to focus for a moment on their professions, which I think is interesting, because it tells us that they each have a profession. Esav is a hunter, right, in source 33. The Esav ish yodeatzayid ish sadeh, the Yaakov ish tam yoshev olim. The pasuk writes them out as a contrast, right? One's inside, one's outside. One is a hunter that is outside in the field, and one is an ish tam, which is very unclear exactly what that means, and he sits inside the tent. Now, the pshat of that read, I mean, number one, I gave you source 34. The obvious of that is, again, the contrast. Yaakov, Hafach, Esav, they're opposites of each other. They have opposite personalities. They have opposite professions. You know, that's already coming through the text. And if you're seeing it as very black and white, well, since I know Yaakov is perfect and Yaakov is wonderful, right, because he's one of our avot, so therefore the contrast would be that Esav must be evil right from the start. But it doesn't necessarily have to be so. If you look at Rashbam, Yodeya Tzai, Latzut Tzai, Lahavi, he's a hunter, versus Yoshevo Alim, Roetzon Avid. Really, the Peshada that is not sitting in the Beit Midrash, that's Chazal's approach to what that means. It means he is a shepherd. One is a shepherd, they're both outside, then one's not really inside the tent. Shepherd versus hunter. And the question, I guess, that you can ask on that is there a value to one versus the other? Do you look at one as an evil profession and one as a good profession? Or do you say these are both valuable professions? We need people who are shepherds and we need people who are hunters. Yeah.
I mean, just like throughout all of Tanakh, I feel like the shepherd's always like the person who's introspective and is a good Jewish leader. Like there's Moshe, there's...
Good. So if you look at my sources, I wrote them out for you. 38, 39, 2 hunters we have that I would assume are evil are Nimrod and Yishmael, though they're both kind of questionable. And the people who are good, we have Yaakov, source 40, source 41, Moshe, source 42, David. These are clearly good characters that are all shepherds. So if you just look at it that way, which is what you just did, which is, well, let me look at hunters in Torah versus shepherds in Torah, clearly the lineup shows positive on one side, negative on the other side. So I should reflect that back on to Esav and Yaakov. Very good. Yeah?
But at the same time, aren't there like more Tanaitic and later sources that are very hard on shepherds that say basically that every shepherd is a thief because they're not careful where their sheep go and whose grass they're eating?
Right, and we also know that Lot is a shepherd to some extent, and there's a negativity about that. And also, if you look through Torah, a lot of these people who are shepherds, because it's like the job, not the chosen job, it's like the degrading job. The Shvatim are shepherds because Yosef is the one who gets to sit at home like a prince. Moshe is the shepherd because he joins a family, and he's given the job as a shepherd because that's the dirty job. Nobody wants it. Oh, you want to join our house? Okay, so you be the shepherd, right? Or David, he's the shepherd. He's the one that's out in the backyard that doesn't even get called in when Shmuel's like, where are your sons? I want to make one king. So to some extent, the vision of shepherds, even though if I look at it through the vision of, well, the Shvatim are shepherds, Moshe is shepherd, David is shepherd, wow, that's respectable. But if I look at it in a different way, all of a sudden I see shepherds is like the ick job. It's the non-favored child job, which fits here too. Yaakov, right? He's the non-favored child. Yitzchak likes Esav more. So who gets to be the shepherd? Who gets the degrading job? Oh, I'll give that to Yaakov. Now all of a sudden it's not so positive versus negative anymore. It actually goes the other way. Yeah.
I just think even if you're going to say that they're both equally good jobs, that it tells me about intrinsically about the type of person that they are. Like a hunter is somebody who, like, no matter what, it's a violent job, even if it's for something productive and good. And a shepherd is a more peaceful job.
Okay. I agree with you. And actually, I gave him a farshan that kind of point that out. But look at source 36. So Spoonie points out that if in order to be a hunter, you have to be a tricky person by personality. You have to be a conniving person, a cunning person, to trick the animal. I mean, that's what hunters are. A mutob rama'ut, like that's what it is. It's about trickery. She'ainti dat chayava ofelo miyah. You can't capture an animal without tricking them. Versus Svarnu in the next source 37, roetzon shaita malacha chachamayo ter malacha tzavodat adamah. It's a smart job. You have to be smart in order to be a shepherd. So it's interesting. You know, you can kind of argue this back and forth a lot of times, but I do find, you know, the question of can we say good versus bad from the start, right when hearing their profession, I think is unclear, but I certainly see that you can say it. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if this plays in at all, but it's interesting to me how it, like, in terms of the progress of human culture, we started with, like, being hunter-gatherers, and then we, like, moved on to agriculture, so, like, agriculture is actually and domesticated animals, it's, like, further along the trajectory. And so you do need more, I mean, you would think that you need more smarts to, like, trap animals, but, like, you also need to have a different kind of smart.
Right, and I would also think that you need to, right, you need smart for both, and also you may need some trickery, I don't know. I'm not a shepherd, so I don't know. But somehow you got to keep them all in one air. You know what I mean? But again,
though,
like, they're biased because Farnu's saying it must be something bad because we're talking about Esav. And we're saying it has to be something good because we're talking about Yaakov. It's interesting. Rashi, as we all know this, Chazal, I just gave it to you here in Rashi, which is that really this is about learning versus not learning, right? I mean, the whole Midrash that one wanted to go to the base Medrash of Vozara, one, right, when she's inside, that's why they're fighting inside of her. And Yoshevo Alein means Allah. This assumption that there's some yeshiva that Yaakov sat in, that's really what it's talking about. Now again, not that that's pshat, a snapshot, but with the ideas of Chazal is, from the moment in time that they are born, Esav is evil and Yaakov is righteous. Even within her stomach, they're fighting over this issue because they have different values. So within this view, Esav is just evil from the second of conception. Like he's not even when he's born. Right, everything about Esav has to be translated as evil. What I find interesting, and as some of you take my Shvatim course, probably remember that I said this then, I find the parallel between Yaakov and Esav in language very similar to the language of Yisachar and Zvolun, which I gave you here in source 44. And Yisachar and Zvolun, we look positively at both of them, which is very interesting. If you look at source 44, Samach Zvolun b'seitecha, the Yisachar b'o'alecha, it's very similar. The Zvolun is the one who goes out, right? And Yisachar is the one who stays in the tent, like Yoshev O'alim, very similar language to that of Yaakov. And even in the Midrash, if you look where I bolded here, Yisachar Yoshev O'seik b'torah, Zvolun Yosef b'yamim, v'bob enotein l'tofiv shal Yisachar. That's mama stealing the language of that we have by Yaakov and Esav. Look at the Rashi gave below, b'piv shal Yitzchak. You know, Esav was like putting meat into his father's mouth. And here we have that imagery being captured in the Midrash, but Yisachar and Zebulun. Zebulun is like literally feeding Yisachar. But here, it's beautiful. They work together. It's lovely and it's wonderful. And this is a good relationship. This isn't one positive, one negative. These are both positive. Let me just finish my thought. And I found in this Malbim, Source 45, fascinating, which was, this was the plan of Yaakov. Yaakov's plan was not to pick one son over the other. He wanted a Yisachar and Zebulun. He wanted one son that was the going out son and the one son that was the staying in son and learning and all of that. And that was his plan. And that's why he was giving a bracha to Esau, because he thought he could unite the brothers to be a Yisachar and Zebulun. But Rivka shamas, and she heard. Meaning Rivka havina kol kavanat Yisach, she knew everything that Yisach was thinking. Efor tela, so he kashrut ben Esau v'Yaakov. He wanted to connect Esau and Yaakov together. He kashrut Yisachar and Zebulun, just like Yisachar and Zebulun. V'leiv of Yisrael. She Yaakov yasuk b'tor v'Esau v'parnes v'tor. He assumed Esau's going to go out, get the food, you know, support him, and Yaakov will sit in the Torah. She knew that he was never going to do that. She knew he was evil, and he was never going to support his brother, and that's why she ruined Yitzchak's plan. I mean, it's a fascinating Malbim, which is based on the parallels to Yisachar and Zebulun, and obviously answering the background question that I'm sure we all have, it's not our topic right now, which is why did Yaakov think that he should give the bracha to Esav? Clearly, again, this is part of this picture. Is it a father who's just blinded, or is it a father who sees good in his son? And there's actually not this evil Esav that we all thought, but he was actually a pretty good guy, and that's why Yaakov wants to give him the bracha, or is it somewhere in the middle? So just from the start of the story, we already see two different versions. Is it Esav evil, 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 or is it Esav is a normal child? He's a hunter, which is a good profession. He's loved by his father because he was a nice guy. Nothing so evil necessarily about him yet. I miss somebody. Yeah.
It's really interesting that we're talking about how Esav is supposed to be the one who's like putting food in the mouth of Yaakov, when with the Nezid later on, it's Yaakov putting food into Esav's mouth. And I think it was Rashi who commented that the word that Esav used, he didn't want to be handed a bowl. He wanted Yaakov to pour the soup down his throat, basically. So it's just interesting.
I'm not sure where to go with that, but that's like extreme laziness.
But then it was Yaakov who was doing that to Esav, kind of taking both roles.
Got it. Okay, I like it. But let's go to that story, which is the next story that you just mentioned, Source 47, which is a continuation of those psukim, which is, of course, the famous story that Esav comes back in and wants some soup, and they trade the bechora. So think about it from two perspectives. Evil Esav is what? Evil Esav is what? That's the easy one. What's the evil Esav? What?
He doesn't care about his before at all, just not perfect.
Right, meaning he, and that's exactly what Rashi says. He's so evil, like he just doesn't think that there's a significance to being a Bechor. He doesn't see an importance of having that status in any sort of way. And you can even extend it to the fact that if he's assuming that as a Bechor he's taking over the chosen nation, he doesn't see a value to the chosen nation. He just doesn't care. He lacks all values that we would think are valuable, and that's why he's so evil. If he's a victim, what's the story? Yeah. Totally. And here is where it's interesting, because we just said that Esav has to be tricky in order to, you know, be a hunter. But we see a lot of trickery in Yaakov. I mean, this is a brother who's taking advantage of another brother who has misjudgment, right? He's starving. He thinks he might die. He'll do anything to just get that cup of soup. And instead of saying, here, my brother, take some food because you're dying or because you're starving, he's like, let's make a trade. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes I look at this story and I see, like, my oldest child with my youngest child, and I'm just like, that's not nice. You know, like when like kids are like they come home sometimes from school and they got like a really bad deal on something, but they don't know, and they're like so excited, and it's like, no, you go back and you go give back what you just got. That's what it sounds like to me. It's like, oh, you want some soup? Sure, you can have a bowl of soup. You give me the bechorah status. I mean, it's really quite unbelievable the way that he manipulated him to make him a victim. Again, the question of how we deal with Yaakov, I think, is part of this discussion, because if we want Yaakov to stay good, we can't look at it that way, but it's an issue on its own, yeah.
Also, like, for the people who's, I don't know who they are, I'm just saying the people, but for the people who say that, like, Esau is gluttonous, and he just, like, demands food, Like, I don't know if they were ever, like, out in the field all day running around after animals, like, coming back. If any of you, like, run, like, somebody, if you come back and you're tired, like, your brain is not working right,
right.
until you get food. Like,
and therefore, I think
not,
the read of Victor Mesov,
you know,
is not a hard one. It's so sharp, which is he was not rational, and later he got more rational. You know, there's a lot of questions within this theory. It doesn't seem that they never tell Yitzhak, because he doesn't seem to know. The dad doesn't seem to know that the Bechorah status has switched in any sort of way. And the question you also have to ask here, is it just like joking? You know what I mean? Like, did they really think, can you say to someone, you're the Bechor now? Like, it doesn't work. You can promise whatever you want, but that doesn't make you the Bechor. The Bechor is the Bechor. You know, even Reuven, who loses the Bechorah, doesn't lose the Bechor status.
But
he loses the privileges of being a Bechor. He doesn't lose the Bechorah. So the question is, was this even serious? Is there any nachgamina from this trade at all? And was it really something that is such an evil story for Esav at all? Is something that's very unclear. Yeah.
Also, like, to really the communication, it even goes back to Rivka. Rivka got this message that, like, the older is going to serve the younger. Like, where was Yitzchak? Like, didn't he know about that message also?
Yeah, she got it in Nevuah, it seems like.
Like, why wouldn't she tell him if she thought it was...
So that's another problem. We've got lots of problems that we need to solve, which is the relationship between Rivka and Yitzchak is a very, very strange one. But that's for another day. I agree with you. That's a very strange relationship. But continue on, source 48, to the next story of Esav. The next story of Esav is Parachat Zion and the Bracha story. We all know the Bracha story. I don't know if you're the second size and you know that, right? Where Yaakov goes and dresses up like Esav and steals the Bracha. Okay. So let's start again. Evil Esav, what are you going to do with this story? What are you going to focus on in the story? Which details of the story are you going to focus on? To make him evil. Nobody. Nobody's going to make him evil?
He made this happen. Like, he gave away the
Bechorah. Okay, so you could say he deserves it because he gave away the Bechorah, and Yaakov was just acting upon a deal that they made. But the details of the story that you're going to focus on are the ending of the story, right? First of all, the fit that he throws, I mean, makes him sound like mamish a baby. I mean, look at the psukim. I mean, he sakag, dolav, and maram, he cries. I mean, how many times they say he cries? It's like really, you know, a little bit humorous, but the focus will be on the end. What does Esav decide at the end? He's going to kill his brother. Meaning that's the focus you're going to take, which is look at this evil guy who deserves it to some extent because he traded the Bechorah, and now he's a murderer because he's saying he's going to kill his brother. How are you going to look at Esav a different way? Which I think is really simple on the psukim, which is what?
He was tricked.
He was taken advantage of. He screams like a baby. Okay, so you might call him immature. You might call him, you know, a baby. You like that. But that doesn't make you evil. That doesn't make you horrible. And if you think about it, he just lost out on this tremendous bracha. I don't really give value to bracha the way that they do. You know, if somebody gives you a bracha or not, I don't think you think that your whole life is going to change. But they certainly seem to, within the psukim of all the brachas that are given, where Yaakov was given a tremendous bracha, he turns to his father and says, give me a bracha. And I don't have a bracha to give you. I gave it away already. Like, it doesn't seem to be like, well, I'll just pick up another one. And then he gives him one that's not so great. And he throws a fit. I mean, you look at him like a victim that's acting like a baby, but a victim. And you do feel bad for him. What about the fact that he doesn't kill his brother?
A normal reaction of like, oh my God, I'm so angry. It's not necessarily that he's actually
going to
do it.
Okay. Meaning, you can argue maybe he really wasn't going to. Why can I argue that? That really, that's just his reaction. I'm so mad, I'm going to kill my brother.
He just thinks it.
He doesn't kill his brother later. Good. And if you really want to kill
someone,
what would you do?
He doesn't chase him.
After him.
He stays.
You know what I mean? Like, is it that he's like, I have no idea where my brother is, and if I could, I would chase him. You know what I mean? Well, he doesn't try. There's no attempt to kill him. It's just Rivka overhears and then kicks Yaakov out of the house really quickly before there possibly could be one. But the question is, did he mean it, did he not, and was he really going to kill his brother? And that takes us to the next story, because that's the question behind the next story. The next story, source 49, is when Yaakov and Esav reunite with each other, and as you so nicely said, he doesn't kill him in the story, so maybe we could reflect backwards, but let's understand the story. This story, to me, blows my mind, because if you read the Pshat of the story, Esav sounds like the nicest guy. Like a big mensch. I mean, look at it, source 49. Vayarat Esav lekrasel, he runs towards him, vayachakeyu, and he gives him a hug, vayipolosav erav, and he pulls on his neck, vayinashakeyu, and he kisses him, and he cries, and he looks up, and he says, who are all these people? He's never met his wives before, these are his nieces and nephews. Who are all them? Oh, these are the people these are all my children, great. And he says, oh, well, thank you so much for giving me a present. Yeshli rabachi, I have a lot, my brother. Yehi lecha, asher lecha, take your stuff back, I don't need your present. Don't give it to me. I mean, this is so nice. And then he says, will you come with me? And he says, no, I won't go with you. He says, why? Because I have too many children. We'll go too slowly. Right? So look at Esau. Pasuk Bet. Nisav nechav echalad nechdecha. Let's travel together. Let's reunite. I miss you, my brother. No, I can't. So Esau then goes back. Oh, so Asiga na'imcha im ha'amashariti. Take some of my people. They'll help you. You'll travel. Yeah, yeah. It's like you read this pasuk and he's the nicest guy in the world. And then you now have a problem. Because if he's the nicest guy in the world, and I take that and I reflect backwards, then I say exactly what she said, which is she never wanted to kill, Esav never wanted to kill Yaakov at all. And Esav is not such a bad guy at all. And pshat-wise, that is what it sounds like. So what does Chazal have to do if I want to keep this vision of evil Esav alive? This is the story I need to manipulate. The other story is I don't need much manipulation, right? I just have to take literally that he really wants to kill Yaakov. But this story I completely have to manipulate. And I'm sure you all know the different views we have of Chazal. He didn't really want to kiss him. He was trying to bite him and his neck turned hard. Or why does he say, I have a lot, my brother? What does Rashi say? Because like he's showing off. I have a lot. I don't need your stuff. And why is it that I want to travel with you? What would be the answer? Why do I want to travel with you?
To keep tabs on you.
To keep tabs on you, or? Because I want to kill you. I want opportunity to kill you. And why do I want to give you my people? To keep tabs on you, and then I could kill you. Meaning, if I look at all these actions, not as what it sounds like from the pshat, is like positive and nice, which is what it sounds like, but if I have that perception of evil Esav, I have to make all of this about something negative, and I have to make all of this about Esav wanting to kill Yaakov. Now let me ask you, why would I say that? Based on what you know, where in the pshat can I say that this is a story of Esav wanting to kill Yaakov, as opposed to a story of Esav reuniting with his brother and actually being quite nice? Where is the pshat reason to say it? Yes? Say again? Number one, he's got 400 men with him. Who has 400 men with him if he's trying to just reunite and give his brother a hug? Can someone argue back at her?
Well, what if that's like who he travels with?
Okay, maybe he has 400 friends. Okay, why else?
Maybe he didn't know if Yaakov
was traveling with a lot of people. So when he gets there, he sees his wife, his children. Maybe that's his first question. Who are all these people, right? And maybe he has his 400 men as kind of like a backup in case Yaakov wants to kill him, but not necessarily because he's trying to kill Yaakov. But I agree with you 100%. One reason is because 400 people are with him. What else? Yes?
Because the last time they were together, he said he was going to kill him.
Good. So I just look at the last story, and he says it. Okay, can you make it better, though? Well, look at the pasuk. I gave it to you here again in source 53. But he still made it's Yaakov as a bracha shavrechal yaviv. Right? He's very mad. He took a bracha.
When Yaakov, when
Yitzchak
dies.
And therefore.
And so
what
parak
does Yitzchak die in?
Yeah, one
before,
maybe?
Yeah, Yitzchak died. Yitzchak's not dead. He's not dead, yet. How do I know that Yitzchak doesn't die until parak lamed hey? How do I know that Yitzchak's not dead? Because Yaakov, when he comes back, goes back to his father's house and lives with Yitzchak. So I know he's alive. Eimukdam doesn't work here. You want to argue that. Because it doesn't work. We know that they live together at the end of Yitzchak's life, that he's living with Yaakov. So therefore, what are you arguing? Now take your argument a little bit better. We know that he said this, and therefore what?
And therefore, he's going to do it.
Meaning the threat's still there, yeah, right? So if I want to say that he's trying to find opportunity to kill Yaakov, now all of a sudden that's not so far-fetched. He said, I'm going to kill Yaakov at some point when my father dies. So therefore, what is he doing now? What would this
stalling.
All be? He's stalling. He's keeping tabs on him. He's befriending him so that
they can go together and...
Right, meaning, is Yaakov at this point going to trust him? We see clearly not. But if we hang out together and I act so nice, then you'll go off on a walk with me and then I'll murder you when our father dies, right? Meaning I'm going to gain an opportunity by putting on a show right now of pretending that I'm being nice to you, but not actually being nice to you. Yeah?
Would the incentive to murder just be for revenge because you messed me over? Or would it actually be to get something, like to get some kind of like right.
To get the Bechorah back would be what I would say.
Is this it work like that? Like I kill you?
Well, I don't know how any of this works. Of I take your Bechorah, I sell your Bechorah and all that stuff. But the assumption of the Bechorah is to get your father's property, correct?
Uh-huh.
So that for sure does work, which is...
Yitzchak
a very rich man. Yitzchak has a lot of property.
Yitzchak's
not dead yet.
Right.
So,
but his plan to kill Yaakov after Yitzchak dies... it won't get him what he wants because he still won't.
So
like,
again,
Yerushalayim,
the question is, what do you get? Is it I'm fighting over the property of my father? Then I agree with you. I should kill you before my father died. Is it I'm gaining? So is it that I'm gaining from my father? Yeah, but he could be lying. That's just like a nice thing to say. Or is it that he's trying to get, again, this idea of the chosen nation and having the chosen lands and all that is what we're talking about, and the Torah is giving you that right, right? Then that's something that I would get after my father dies. Look at this midrash with me because it answers your question. Hold on 1 second. In Source 55, Esav looks to Cain and says Cain was an idiot. Why? Because Cain kills Hevel, assuming he's going to get everything from his father. Again, not physical property, but this promise of a future and the future, you know, nations of the world. And then what happens? His father has another child by the name of Shade, and Cain gets nothing. So Esav says, well, let me look to Cain and say, well, I better wait till my father's dead, and there's no possibility of a third child, and then I'll get everything. So here, this midrash idea is not about property, because I agree with you. Yaakov's property, if he already inherited Yitzhak's land, would then go to his children. But rather, it's talking about this greater picture of inheriting the world, meaning the chosen nation, the chosen land, all those promises that they grew up with their father saying, I've been promised this, and one day one of you will get this, and this is amazing, and you're going to be the chosen nation, and your children will be of the stars and the sun. That's what they're fighting over. And I agree with you that we're not sure which one they're fighting over, but it would make more sense that if he's literally waiting, again, one could be I'm just waiting until my dad's old, doesn't mean until my father is dead, or is it I'm waiting until my father's dead, that would seem to be what they are fighting about. Yeah.
So why is that one or the other?
That's just one idea in the model. That's not a common idea.
Most
is what I would
believe
say.
It's one or the other.
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, 100%. Anyway, and then I gave in source 56 and 57, for time for you to read on your own, actual midrashim that capture a almost murder of Esav to Yaakov. Like two different times where Esav actually tried to murder Yaakov. And this is all within that view of Esav is so horrible, he really means it literally. He's going to kill Yaakov. He's trying to find opportunity to find Yaakov. And look, he tries to. In source 56, Yehuda murders him first. And in source 57, Yaakov actually murders him. It depends on which chazal you take. We don't know who kills Esav, right? We all know that his head rolled in. That's a chazal. It's not a psukim. At all, and it's a question of exactly what's that story? When they were burying Yitzhak, like mamish as they were burying him, he goes to try to attempt Yaakov. And that's all part of this idea of to the moment, this whole thing was pretend. All he wanted to do was kill his brother. That's all he wanted to do. The second his father died, that's the first thing he tries to do. But I think, let's make this picture of Esav a little fuzzier, besides for the story itself. I find other reasons why I question making Esav like this horrible, horrible villain. Number one, as we mentioned by Abraham, let's mention it here too, Yitzhak clearly likes him and Yitzhak chooses him. You got to wonder, again, how would he choose someone that's so obviously evil in that sort of way? Number two, source 58. If you look at source 58, I always found this pasuk so interesting. Esav goes and he marries, in general, someone from Canaan, and then he hears his father telling Yaakov, don't marry someone from Canaan, pasuchet. Vayar Esav ki ra'ot banot Canaan b'nei Yitzhak aviv. So Vayelech Esav al Yishmael ve'ikach et machla ba Yishmael ben Avram achot nevayoda anoshav lo li'isha. It's like Esav is trying to please his father. This is not a guy who's like, I hate this religion and I'm terrible. The pasuk says he saw that his father didn't like the no Canaan, but his dad never told him. So okay, now that you don't like it, I'll go and I'll marry someone not from Canaan. Now, it's clear from the pasuk he adds it onto his wife. It's not like he gets rid of his wives that are from Canaan. So I'm not telling you that he's perfect here, but I see kind of this like grayness in Esav. Like he's trying to please his father. He's trying to do the right thing to some extent. Obviously, also source 60, he buries his father. Again, you can say that they hate each other. His name does come first, so you could say that he's not recognizing that Yaakov is, the chosen one. But okay, he buries his father. But here's the story that I think everybody mistakenly does not know about. Source 61. And the reason why people don't realize it is because Bereishis Lamed Vav is a listing of Esav's children. But in the middle of that list, there's actually a story that, we skip over because we're like, name. But Yikach Esav es nashav, es banav, es benotav, es kol nevasho beitzo, ve'elz miknehu, ve'elz kol behemto, ve'elz kol kinyano, asher v'chash be'eretz Canaan, v'yelech al eretz mipnei Yaakov achiv, ki ayah v'chusham rav mishavetz yachtav, v'lo yachla eretz mikoreim laseto tam mipnei b'pneihem, v'yashav Esav b'har seir Esav hu edo. He leaves Eretz Yisrael. He leaves Eretz Yisrael over to his brother. Make that bad. Bad Esav. What do I do with that?
Doesn't want to be under the influence.
Okay, doesn't want to be under the influence of his brother. Yeah.
just like can't stand being around him and is saying, I don't care about Eretz Yisrael, I don't care about my Yerusha. What I care about is having enough room for my stuff.
Okay, so I'm going to not just say that he wants to stay far away from his brother. I'm rejecting the value of Eretz Yisrael. And what language, what does this parallel us to? The language of this, very beautifully, to Avram and Lot. And therefore, it's kind of the Lot who's rejecting the values of Abraham, doesn't see the value of Eretz Yisrael, leaves and goes to the land of Sodom because Kulam Ashka, there's more wealth there. So this is Esav, and what story of Esav is this paralleling? How we read in this version of Evil Esav, how we read which story? You even said it. The Bechorah story, right? I don't see the value in the Bechorah, so I reject it and I give it to you. And here I don't see the value in all of the promises of Bechorah, and I don't see the value in Eretz Yisrael, and I don't see the value in anything. So I'm just going to pick myself up and go to this better piece of land that gives me more space, as you said, Evie, or that gives me more riches, or that gives me more ability to have my own autonomy. I don't want to have any influence of my brother and my brother's values, Eretz Yisrael. I just reject the whole thing. That's evil Esav if you look at the story. Can someone flip it for me?
He's finally acknowledging that, like, this is not his.
Yeah. This could be Ace of saying, this is not my land. This is your land. You got picked at the end of the day. You got the brush at the end of the day. This is not my land. So I'm going to pick myself up, and I'm going to leave. Because this isn't the land that is supposed to be mine. This is the land that's supposed to be yours. And then, to me, you kind of see a difference in Esav, which is, it could be in the beginning, you know, Esav just never valued this, but it's not like he was evil. It could be he was even manipulated to some extent. It could be he wanted to murder his brother. It could be he didn't want to murder his brother. It's really unclear. It could be he even tries to make peace with his brother at the end. And then it could be at the end that he peacefully moves out, meaning we really could look at that last story as very peaceful, and then he peacefully moves away and leaves this home, the land of Israel, to Yaakov, because that's his home. I think that's a different way of looking at Esav. He's not so evil at the end of the day if you look at Esav that way. I gave you a source 62 before we conclude, or whatever comments you want to say, is Shaddal. The Shaddal, I love Shaddal. He's like one of my favorite mepharshim. And he gives like a middle ground to the two reads. And he says it as follows. If you want, let's, I'll read some of it inside. V'tokin ha'seh ha'zeh l'dati haya. This is the story. Ki Yaakov haya osek tamid b'tzarchei habayit. Okay, let's go back. He's like the full picture. That's what I love. It says, Yaakov was inside the home. What is that? He's not learning. He was taking care of the home. He was the one who managed the house. And literally, Yaakov was the one who fed Esav. He would come home every day, and he'd eat what was in the house. When you go hunting, what's the reality of hunting? Sometimes you come home with food, and sometimes you don't. So they didn't rely on Esav on a daily basis. When Esav brought home food, fantastic, then they ate it. But if Esav didn't bring food that day because he was not successful in his hunting, Yaakov was the one who was managing the home, and he fed everyone. Every once in a while, Esav brought home food. But in general, if you look, when it comes to all the avot, the way they made their money, the way that they survived, was because they were shepherds. That's what they did. And they had their own animals, and they ate their own animals. They didn't hunt other people's animals. They had their own, and that's what they ate. The Esav lo haya ozer ba'atachav kolal. He didn't help his brother at all. He was like one of those that was absent. He went out hunting, and every once in a while he came home with something. But besides that, Yaakov took care of everything. But Yaakov haya mitzar al zem. This was a problem for Yaakov. She'ar kol amal hanhagah habay mutal alav, because all the burden of taking care of the home fell on him. Velo shum schar, and he got no reward because Esav was going to get the bracha. His chachav l'shol mimo, I think that word's wrong. He decided that he's going to fix this imbalance, but it's imbalance that he deserved. And that's what he did when he asked him to give me the Bechorah. Because I deserve it, I take care of the home, but what does it mean? What does it mean to ask for the Bechorah? He goes on to prove that it's not to have the older person status, because that doesn't make any sense, because if you want that status, you'd have to tell Yitzchak. And then, you know, he would assume that he's supposed to get the bracha. Like, all of these things is just not true. Alkein omer ani, do you see it? I bolded it for you also? Or I just skipped the middle? What did I do for you? Okay, so go where I bolded the second time, just for time. Alkein omer ani, so the middle was just him proving that it can't be like real Bechorah status. What is it that he was taking from him? Alkein omer ani, shalo haya inyan ha-mecher hazeh, elo shenishpa Esav, that's what I should say. Ki acharei mot aviv yaniach li Yaakov. Okay, I missed a lot of words. Sheyeh apatrofus v'manhig et habayit. All he was asking him is that when our father dies, I inherit the home. I take care of the home, so I should get the home. You don't do anything for the house. I'm not taking your status. I just want to inherit the house. He wanted the ability that Esav couldn't then, at the end of him taking care of everything all these years, Esav to come back and say, you get out. You get out of the land. You get out of the house. And then he wouldn't be able to inherit Eretz Yisrael. That would be a problem. They have to tell Yitzchak this because this was an event that was going to occur after Yitzchak died. And that's what happens in the story. It's just Esav doing his promise. So he's leaving. He's saying, you're right. You inherited the house. You inherited this land. And now I'm leaving. And here's what's interesting, because here's three views. Esav is evil, evil, evil. Esav is evil from the beginning to the end. He's evil in his profession. He wants to kill his brother. He doesn't deserve the bracha because he doesn't value the Bechora, and therefore Yaakov was right to take it from him. He's a murderer. He tries to murder his brother by tricking him later on, or tries to hurt him later, and therefore he needs to leave Eretz Yisrael because he doesn't deserve it, and he doesn't see the value in Eretz Yisrael. That's one view of Esav. Second view of Esav is that he's a victim, and you feel bad for Esav because he makes a stupid trade, and he doesn't understand the value, and then his brother tricks him and takes away the bracha, and then later he genuinely tries to reunite with his brother, and he's even nice enough at the end to say, even though I've been living in Eretz Yisrael all these years, and you've been living in Haran this entire time, I will leave, and I'll leave the land behind for you. That doesn't make him such a villain. Or you have someone in between. You have someone who kind of like deserves the reality that he got, but he's not as evil as we thought. He's someone who just is not around. He's someone that doesn't deserve to inherit the home, but yet he's someone at the end who goes on his agreement. I agree that I would leave at the end, so I'm going to leave at the end. You know, villains, if you're absolute villain, you know, any movie, a villain, he lies, right? Sure, I promise you that. No way. And then he goes back on his lie. You know, in this view of Shaddai, it's kind of this middle approach. He's not a good person, and none of them are saying he's a tzaddik in any sort of way, but this is just someone at the end of his life saying, I promise this, and therefore I'm going to step up and do my promise, which is exactly what I said I would do. So here's my question at the end of the day, which is to me, and then I gave you a nice chart that kind of showed some parallels between Yishmael and Esav, if you look at it on his own. You know, why? Why do we have kind of these different pictures of villains? I understand when it comes to tzaddikim, you know, why we kind of have different views, but why by villains are there? And I want to just state what I believe, and then I'd love to hear whatever you do, which is as follows. You know, the black and white picture of Chazal is very simplistic to some extent, though it's complicated within trying to get it into the psukim. But I'm saying it's more simplistic of a message. Be like a good guy, don't be like a bad guy. It's a very simple message, but it's a good message because confusion and grayness is difficult. It's a difficult in terms of teaching values. It's difficult in terms of life. I mean, in modern Orthodoxy, we live in a world of gray. It's not an easy world. It's not an easy world to live in any sort of way. And therefore, when one wants to give over values, the value is very simple. Be like Avram, and he's amazing, and don't be like Yishmael because he's not so great. Don't be like Esav because he's not so good. And that's why I think we have these kind of ways of looking at good and evil, because you compare and contrast, and now I know what's good and now I know what's bad. When you start to make them gray, though, however, it gets a lot more confusing. But in my mind, I think it makes it an even better value, because as I just said before, our world is gray. Like, we live in a world of gray. And I do believe that if God didn't want us to analyze the villains, he wouldn't have given us so much information. There's a reason why we hear about all the children of Ishmael, all the children of Esav, because they matter. They matter. They're part of the story. They're part of the picture. We could have heard much less about them if God wanted to. If our only purpose was to hear about the good guys, we didn't need to hear so much about the villain. And I think that is to learn the lesson of grayness within people, because every person you deal with in your life, I pray that all your friends are Avrams, you know what I mean? But they're not. Your friends are not Avrams, and people that you live with and people that you deal with are gray. They have good qualities and they have bad qualities, and they do good things and they do bad things, and you need to know how to deal with all types of people. And I think that's the message of learning about Esav, is that you can learn that you can have someone like Esav who is deemed as a bad guy, but can have good qualities and can do good things, and we can see good things about Esav, and maybe even you can learn the quality of kibbutz from Esav, and you can learn the quality of keeping a promise from Esav if you learn like Shaddai. You know, there are values that you can see in every person, and I think that one way is a simpler message of good, bad, learn good, don't learn bad, and it's easier. But one message is see good in people. You know, you see the complication of when you think something is bad and realize that maybe it's not as bad as you thought. It's complicated. People are complicated. Life is complicated. And I think that's the message that I see when I analyze an ASAP, when I analyze a Yishmael. I see a complication, and I see complication is in a good sense because the world is complicated. And I think that that is the message I see. I'm curious, and we have 3 minutes to go, what's the message you see when we finish this year in terms of, I don't know if this was something that was obvious to you before, that there are different views of how we view Esav and Yishmael, but what's the message that you would take home from something of this sort? Pressure on the spot. Good, Dana.
It's kind of similar to like how I view the whole idea that tzaddikim are not like these perfect models. Like, everyone in their lives are going to make mistakes. They might feel like they're not necessarily the best person, but like there's value to that. Like even the worst person isn't 100% evil. So like even in our lives when we mess up, like that's okay. Like they're still looking good. Like no one's 100% evil. So like.
I agree. It's not just about you and the world. It's about you and yourself. And sometimes when people do something bad, they don't know how to let go of a mistake that they make. And the point here is you can be the evil Esav and just continue the same mistake over and over again, and that would put you in the more black and white mode. Or you could be an Esav that maybe changes things around, and therefore you could be that person that moves on from a mistake. And I don't have to say that that's like an Esav. That could be like a David, if you take the view of David also, you know, that people make mistakes and they can grow from them. Yeah.
I think it can also just be brought into like everything of Torah and Halakha. Like, nothing is so starkly black and white, and just taking a lesson that, like, you might think that certain halachot are a certain way, but if that's, like, a really bad thing in your life, or, like, everything can be changed, and everything can
right.
be different.
I agree with you.
And
also,
cool and,
what's interesting about what you just said is when you learn Gemara, when you learn Halakha, often examples that are given in the Gemara and Halakha is extremes. Because it's trying to say that if it's true for this case, well, then Kal v'chomer is true for all the cases in between. So to some extent, I think that's what Chazal is doing. Like, extremes, good and evil, because I want you to see the extremes, and then I'm supposed to, on my own, figure out the middle ground. And it's kind of the exact same way when we learn Gemara and when we learn Halakha. Sometimes these cases that come out of the Gemara are like, what a crazy, ridiculous case. But the reason is because it's so extreme to show me the extreme, so that I can obviously figure out the Kal v'chomer of everything. No, I'm 100% with you, yeah.
Whatever
you want.
I like the idea of the brain and the capacity of people. But I think you can also come out with the importance of just, like, sometimes I think that, like, it's out of touch for him, he sees, like, the complexity of man, and he can deal with that in the dark. But from our perspective, sometimes I think, like, it's better to see people in black and white in terms of, like, how we deal with them. In terms of like public justice, because sometimes you see people like when people in the, let's say you're doing something to some people, and then there's so much justification for it that at the end of it you know he's really doing the right thing. And sometimes I think like no, just did the evil act and judge him for that and take it as black and white. And if he also helped an old lady across the street, like he'll get you know he'll get spot cut. That's not where we should necessarily come. There's the importance of just being like for the purposes of, even though I'm thinking personally, I know that all people are alive. For the purposes of like society, I will judge him as equal and also know that like
I'll let you react to that.
So yeah. I think that's true in some cases. I think like O.J. Simpson, I don't think it's an example of a complex situation. I think it's an example of a fairly like obvious situation was like made complex by like lawyers and it shouldn't have been. But I disagree that thinking that people are simple and simple. You said like for the justice, like for the sake of society, it's better. I don't know, like judging by like the prison crisis and like how many people we have in jails now that are doing on society that are expensive for society that would have been less expensive if we had put them through some kind of counseling program and let them into the workforce as opposed to putting them in jail. I think like the kind of like one-sided view that like our prosecutors have of just like, oh, he did a petty crime, therefore there is option A, release him, option B, put him in jail, and like there is no middle road that would like relieve the prisons, that would like have this person like have a beneficial life, but I think it's nice to say like, I agree. I think, like, sometimes we live in a very, like, subjective world, and therefore it's, like, we, like, our minds are very, are like, but no, we need our hard minds. But I don't know if, in, like, the broad sense, if that's actually as helpful as
it is. You know, we have different groups. I'm getting faces from the professor. But I actually think this is a fascinating debate that we could probably do for a good hour. And it's something that I think we all relate to on different ends, meaning there are some times where it's someone that is so evil and you're like, why are people rationalizing for them? But sometimes if you know that person, it's hard for you to understand the people who are calling them so evil for one act of evil and not seeing the bigger picture. I don't think one way is MS and one way is not. I think that's the two ways that we do it in Tanakh, and that's the two ways that we do it in reality, and I think that there's MS to both. So you may like the black and white view, somebody else in this room may like the gray view. I think you're both